CLUIN seminar. My name is Jean Valent. I'm coming to you from the EPA's Technology, Innovation, and Field Services Division, where I'll be serving as the online moderator for our live broadcast. In just a moment, I'm going to pull up our presentation materials, but while I'm waiting, I'm going to give our latecomers just an extra minute or so to hop on the line and take advantage of a new functionality we'll be introducing in today's session. If you've never participated in a CLUIN webinar today, I'm going to remind you that for our broadcast, you should have registered online and received an email that would have had a whole set of instructions on how to join us. That email would have pointed you to something called the CLUIN seminar homepage, where you can read more about the event, find contact information and bios for the presenters. You'll also be able to download presentation materials, provide feedback, but most importantly, there's a Go to Seminar button in the upper left corner. If you click that button, you'll actually be asked to identify yourself, check in online, and it'll bring you to an interactive room that we'll be using for today's broadcast. In just a moment, I'll cover that room in more detail, and I just wanted to wait just a moment, and it looks like we do have just over 100 individuals who have hopped on the line and joined us for today's broadcast. So it looks like we can take a look at some of the results we already have up on the screen. In the interactive Adobe Connect room, for those of you that have just hopped on, there are two poll questions in the lower left corner. We're going to be using these poll questions throughout today's broadcast to provide some real-time interaction with our presenters as they guide you through the materials. Just as an example, we've actually posed two questions to our live audience today. In the lower left corner, you'll see a poll asking how many years of experience in the oil spill response field you have. And then to the right of that, we're asking our participants to indicate what organization they represent. To vote on those polls, you simply click the circle to the left of the answer that best meets your individual response. It does look like about 44% of our audience is brand new to the oil spill response. So out of those over 100 individuals, just under a half of them are brand new. About 15% are about 3 to 10 years, and then about a third of the audience has more than 10 years of experience. Surprisingly, about 10% of you have actually never worked in the oil spill response field. In terms of organizations, it looks like about a third of our audience is coming in from state, local, or tribal organizations. About a quarter of you are private sector. We do have about 20% of you making up EPA regional offices, and then the rest reflect either other federal agencies, EPA headquarters staff. We do have some international government representatives here, and then other individuals joining us. So a great big welcome to all of you who have hopped on the line. Let me get started with our official instructions for today's broadcast, so we can turn things over to our presenters in just one moment. We've already covered when you come into the seminar. We are going to be broadcasting the entire session live through Adobe Connect, which means if you haven't noticed it already, you'll be able to watch in real time as our presenters deliver their talks. We have the ability to control movement through the presentation slides, so you can actually sit back and watch as they deliver these talks through Adobe Connect. Everyone can listen to the broadcast online through Adobe Connect using speakers or headphones. If you're having any problems, though, with our software, you can't get into the online room, you can download the materials and follow along on the phones. However, we do encourage you to try to work with us to troubleshoot those problems so we can get you in for the full interactive component today. As I mentioned, online audio is available for everyone. You'll see a control in the upper left side of your screen. Looks like a speaker icon. As long as that's clicked in and shaded bright green, the online stream is up and running. To adjust the volume, simply use your own speaker or volume controls. If that doesn't work for you, we do have toll-free call-in information for anyone who needs it. Just use the Q&A window you see in the lower right corner of your screen to submit a request for it, and I'll share that call-in number with everyone who needs it. Please know if you join us on the telephone lines, though, all of the phone lines will be globally muted. We ask that you remain on that mute to cut down on background noises or other disruptions. We will be using a Q&A tool in the lower left corner to collect questions and comments, as well as to let our participants report technical problems at any time. You already have two welcome messages from me in that window. To submit a question or comment, simply click your cursor on the thin white box in the lower right corner of your screen and start typing your question. This is a private submission. No one else will be able to read your question or comment aside from myself and the presenters. We will take designated breaks, and at that time, I'll start reading out the questions, and we'll try to address as many questions as we can in the time that we have allotted. Again, you can use that same process to submit technical problems or report a lost audio to get the call-in information. We will also be using an interactive polling functionality that you guys saw when you first joined today's session, so keep your eyes alert on the screen. Today's session is being recorded and will be automatically available for free replay and download from the Clouin website. We're going to try to get that thing done later today so that we can let people who missed out live participate in part two, which will be delivered tomorrow. If you want to learn more about what we do on Clouin, we do have over 500 recorded seminars available for access on our archive page. So again, you're going to see the majority of your presentation material here in the main portion of your screen. You can click the full screen button here at any time in the upper right of that window to make the slides larger. To shrink them back down, simply press full screen down again. I encourage you to be careful of popping in and out of full screen. We will be using some very cool interactive tools, so let's make sure you guys stay aware of all the windows that are up there today. You'll see our Clouin logo. And then just below that in the bottom right corner of the screen is our very important Q&A window, which will permit you to submit questions, comments, or report technical problems at any time. I think that's going to be the end of the reminders that I have for today's broadcast. So I'm going to go ahead and ask if I can have either Earl or one of my other presenters provide just a brief overview of the disclaimer that you guys will be following for today's presentation material.
All right, Jean. This is Earl Liverman. And on behalf of all instructors, I would like to note that the purpose of this presentation is to stimulate thought and discussion. We hope that you'll experience a discussion amongst ourselves as we complement each other's presentations and perhaps correct each other if in the event we should misspeak. And it's also important to note that nothing in this presentation is intended to supersede or contravene federal statutes, regulations, or official EPA policies.
Gene, this is Jim. I'm going to ask Earl to start with the introduction. I'm still having technical difficulties. I'll be working on it.
All right, Jim. Thank you. Well, we're very fortunate today to have a cadre of very experienced EPA on-scene coordinators. In addition to myself, I'm very fortunate to be located in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. I've been involved with EPA's remedial and emergency response and removal programs for a number of years. Greg Weigel is also a senior OSC. Assigned to Region 10, and Greg is located in Boise, Idaho, which is in the southern portion of the state. Similarly, Greg brings a wealth of experience related to oil spills, CERCLA removal actions, and also has experience at headquarters. Doug Kadama is part of this team, and he joins us from the East Coast. As you can see, he's from Region 10 and works in a variety of different states and locations. And in particular, since the mid-1980s, Doug has worked all but exclusively in the emergency response and oil spill preparedness and prevention programs. So we're very, very fortunate to have Doug's involvement, particularly from a management perspective, as part of this presentation. And I suspect I'm saving the best for last, and that is Jim Mullins. Jim is an extraordinary former EPA employee out of Region 10. He has a wealth of experience in oil spill and hazardous waste response programs. So that's your cadre of instructors. We're all anxiously looking forward to this, and we hope that this presentation is as rewarding for you as it has been for us over these past many months preparing it. Okay, well, let's get started. Oil spill response, day one. By way of introductions, you've met your instructors, you have a sense of our work experience. Gene has provided a sense as well as to the number of people who have enrolled in this course. We're very, very fortunate to have people from federal, state, local, tribal entities, as well as international participants, and we're all very appreciative of the time you've set aside to be a part of this presentation, not only this morning, but tomorrow as well. This is a brief overview of each day's agenda. Today, over the course of 3 hours, we hope to cover the statutory and regulatory authority for EPA's ability to respond to an oil spill. We're also going to spend some time discussing the Oil Spill Liability Trust Fund in order to make sure that we share in a similar foundation. Doug Kadama will speak to what is oil, and we'll also discuss the fate and behavior of oil in the environment. And then the final module that we'll cover today are both those human and environmental factors, or variables, if you will, that affect response and cleanup decisions. And we anticipate that this will take the better part of the 3 hours that we have allotted. Tomorrow is a little bit different. What we will look at in greater detail is the statutory and regulatory authority thresholds for responding to oil spills. Then we will look at the overall oil spill management model, if you will. What is it that federal OSCs, what is their template, if you will, when we respond to an oil spill? And for those of you who may not be OSCs, hopefully this will provide a better understanding of how we think and how we will approach a situation and how you could look for opportunities to become a part of that overall response effort. And then Greg will spend some time describing a number of oil spill response techniques. As I suspect you can well imagine, that there are a wide variety of different techniques that are available for responding to oil lands, our inland spills, marine spills, and the like. And some are relatively straightforward, and others are much more sophisticated, and some require a much higher level of approval, and we'll go over all of that. And then, like with anything, at the end of the response, you are left with debris and waste. And that could take on a whole new dimension than perhaps what you were addressing as part of the cleanup. And we'll spend some time going over that issue. And then we'll conclude with a summary statement. So that's what we have laid out for you over these next 2 days. All right, the course overview is provided in these next two slides, and it's just more of a more in-depth presentation of the various things that I've gone over. I'm not going to read this to you, but I would like to highlight one thing. As Jim has reminded me time and time again as we've developed this course, we're flying over this anywhere from maybe 40 to 60,000 feet or more. We are covering topics over the course of 6 hours that many of us have come to learn about only as a result of years, if not decades, of experience. And frankly, as I was preparing for this, I was reminded of so many things that I had forgotten or failed to interpret in the proper way. So what I'm telling you is that we're not going to make you experts in any part of this. Rather, what we hope to do is to give you a familiarity, an awareness, just a basic understanding of this large and complicated field of oil spill response, so that if you were to ever have to respond, you'd have a better foundation for doing so, or if you're interested in this field, incidental to your job, be it whatever it may, at least you have a sense as to what to say, how to ask questions, and where to go to get additional information. So that's it. We hope to give you a big view picture, not make you experts, And let's get started. Okay, are there any questions? I suspect, Gene, this is your point to ask if there's any questions before we get started.
At this point, again, if you do have any questions, you can submit them using the Q&A window in the lower right corner of your screen. Simply click your cursor on that bottom field or box, start typing away. But right now, we don't have any questions coming in from the audience, so I think you guys can go ahead and progress on.
All right. Well, thank you, Gene. The first module, it's titled Statutory and Regulatory Authority. As you can well imagine, the federal government's responsibilities for emergency response are established by statute and by executive orders issued by the president. The purpose of this module is to provide an overview of certain statutes, executive orders, and regulations so that you better understand EPA's statutory and regulatory authority for responding to oil spills. The Federal Water Pollution Control Act of 1948 was the first major U.S. law to address water pollution. While it's hard to imagine today, discharging raw sewage and pollution into our harbors and rivers had been common practice for most of the nation's history, with devastating results. By the late 1960s, perhaps some of you will recall that Lake Erie had become so polluted that Time magazine described it as dead, and bacteria levels in the Hudson River were 170 times above the safe limit. In 1972, this landmark law reversed the course of this behavior. The act took a completely new approach to environmental protection. For example, the Clean Water Act made it unlawful to discharge any pollutants from a point source into navigable waters unless a permit was obtained, and this permit is EPA's National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System permit, or NPDES permit, and no more open sewers were allowed to dump crud and other waste into local streams or bays. Waste otherwise flushed down drains and toilets needed a different approach, so the Clean Water Act provided for billions of dollars in grants to construct and upgrade publicly owned sewage treatment works around the nation to protect lands that filter and purify water as it flows by. Permits were also required for draining and filling of wetlands, and perhaps some of you are familiar with this as a 404 permit. The Oil Pollution Act was signed into law in August of 1990, largely in response to rising public concern about the Exxon Valdez incident. In late March of 1989, shortly after midnight, the oil tanker Exxon Valdez struck the Bligh Reef in Prince William Sound, Alaska, spilling more than 11 million gallons of crude oil. This spill was the largest in U.S. history, and as I suspect you can imagine, tested the abilities of local, national, and industrial organizations to prepare for and to respond to a disaster of such magnitude. Many factors complicated the cleanup efforts following the spill, to include the size of the spill and its remote location, which was accessible only by helicopter and boat, and all of this combined to make government and industry efforts difficult and tested existing plans for dealing with such an event. As I suspect you can also imagine, that the spill posed threats to the delicate food chain that's present in Prince William Sound, to include the commercial and recreational fisheries, as well as migratory shorebirds and waterfowl, and hundreds of mammals such as sea otters and dozens of other species. And to this day, EPA, the Coast Guard, and other entities are still dealing with the consequences of this unfortunate incident. Now, as I mentioned earlier, the federal government's responsibility for emergency response is established by statute and by executive orders. These statutes include the Stafford Act, which is the authority for the federal government to respond to disasters and emergencies that are beyond the capabilities of our local and state partners to respond to, the Clean Water Act and the Oil Pollution Act, RCRA, or the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, which gives EPA authority to control hazardous waste from cradle to grave, the Emergency Planning and Community Right to Know Act, which establishes a chemical emergency response planning infrastructure at state and local level, and CERCLA, which is the Comprehensive Environmental Response Compensation and Liability Act, or Superfund, which provides broad federal authority to respond directly to releases or threatened releases of hazardous substances, pollutants, or contaminants that may endanger public health or the environment. We also have executive orders, including 12580, which is Superfund implementation for other federal agencies, as well as Executive Order 12777, which addresses implementation of Section 303 of the Clean Water Act, which delegates to EPA specific authorities under the National Oil and Hazardous Substances Pollution Contingency Plan. At this point, you may be asking yourself, why are we discussing the Clean Water Act and CERCLA? And the reason we are is that these are the statutes that are most commonly used by on-scene coordinators and in some instances remedial project managers and others, both EPA and the Coast Guard, and it's important to have an understanding as to both the similarities and the differences. Some of those similarities and differences are significant, and it just simply pays to know about it. A couple of things I'd like to point out on this particular slide is spill reporting. If a spill were to occur, by statute, there is a responsibility to notify the National Response Center. And it's also important to note that many states also have reporting requirements. For example, in the state of Idaho, there is a state reporting requirement on one hand, and on the other hand, there is a federal. And also, it's important to note that our removal authority is for both actual discharges or release, as well as the threat. Okay, on this particular slide, a couple of things to point out. With respect to the second bullet item, what we have here is a longstanding EPA policy to pursue enforcement first. Under this policy, EPA seeks, as appropriate, to find responsible parties to perform the cleanup actions. However, if RPs are unable to perform the response actions or are unwilling to do so, there are other mechanisms that EPA can use to perform the cleanup itself. And for those CERCLA actions, there's what is referred to as Superfund, and for the Clean Water Act, there is the Oil Spill Trust Fund, which we'll talk more about here later on this afternoon. Okay, on this slide, I'd like to draw your attention to the first bullet item, and that is the Clean Water Act and the Oil Pollution Act addresses navigable waters and adjoining shorelines. In other words, it focuses on surface waters. As Matt Carr, an OSC in Region 10 in Anchorage, is very fond of saying, it has nothing to do with the clean, with soil or dirt. CERCLA, on the other hand, is different. CERCLA is unique in that the scope of the statute enables OSCs to respond to any environmental media. Whether that be air, soil, surface water, or groundwater. Okay, a couple of things to point out here. With respect to the second bullet item, this is oftentimes referred to as the CERCLA 121E exemption, which exempts any response action conducted entirely on site from having to obtain a federal, state, or local permit. This applies to CERCLA only. In general, what it means is that for those on-site actions, a CERCLA action need comply with only the substantive aspects of the regulation and not with the corresponding administrative requirements. Unfortunately, there is not a similar permit exemption provision that's associated with the Clean Water Act. So as a practical matter, what that means is that when we respond to an oil spill incident, we are unable to bring in the concept of ARARs or applicable or relevant and appropriate requirements. And depending upon the particular issue that we might be dealing with, we are unable to waive compliance with what those regulatory requirements might otherwise impose upon us. It's a very, very important distinction. Okay, with respect to this slide, I'd like to draw your attention to the second bullet item, and in particular, what is referred to as pollution removal funding agreements, or PRFAs. These are tools that are available to quickly obtain needed services and assistance from other government agencies, federal, state, or local, as well as recognized Indian tribes. What this means is a practical matter. If one of us or one of you were to be responding to a remote location and there were resources that you needed immediately, that if you were to deploy your own resources from a remote location, it would just take too long. But by having PRFAs available, Greg, for example, could immediately obtain those services. And Greg and others perhaps will talk about that in greater detail in the following module. Okay, the discharge of oil regulation, 40 CFR 110, this is commonly referred to as the Sheen rule. And this rule applies to both petroleum and non-petroleum oils. This regulation also provides several exemptions from complying, and those include properly functioning vessel engines, such that if there's a discharge of oil from a properly functioning engine, those are not deemed to be harmful and therefore need not be reported. Research and development releases. The EPA administrator may permit the discharge of oil on a case-by-case basis. NPDES permitted releases and discharges permitted under international law. And in this instance, MARPOL is the law, and it's the International Convention for the Prevention of Pollution from Ships. So this is the so-called Sheen rule. And the threshold is very low, frankly. Sheen means an iridescent appearance on the surface water, and you can see what sludge means. We'll talk about this in greater detail during tomorrow's session, because as I suspect you can well imagine, this is not absolute. As is typically the case, you have many and varied site-specific conditions and factors that you take into consideration with each and every incident. Okay, having gone through the statutes and one regulation, I'd now like to spend a few moments talking about the NCP, or the National Oil and Hazardous Substances Pollution Contingency Plan. As you can read, this is the blueprint that we use. The first NCP was developed and published in 1968 in response to a massive oil spill from the oil tanker Courier Torrey Canyon off the coast of England the year before. More than 37 million gallons of crude oil spilled in the water, causing massive environmental damage. To avoid the problems faced by officials involved with responding to this incident, U.S. officials developed a coordinated approach to cope with potential spills in United States waters. Congress has broadened the scope of the NCP over many years. As required by the Clean Water Act in 1972, the NCP was revised in 1973 to include a framework for responding to hazardous substance spills as well as oil discharges. Following passage of the Superfund legislation in 1980, the NCP was broadened to cover releases at hazardous waste sites requiring emergency removal actions. And over the years, additional revisions have been made to the NCP to keep pace with the enactment of legislation. The latest revisions to the NCP were finalized in 1994 to reflect the oil spill provisions of the Oil Pollution Act of 1990. I'd like to spend a few moments going over the key provisions of the NCP with you. With respect to the first bullet item, it provides the responsibilities, if you will, of federal on-scene coordinators to direct response efforts and to coordinate all other efforts at the scene of a discharge or release. And with respect to the fourth bullet item and the listing of federal agencies, the list of other agencies that are brought into play by the NCP is large. It includes the ATSDR, the Agency for the Toxic Substances and Disease Registry, the Department of Commerce, the Department of Defense, the Department of Energy, the Department of Interior, the Department of Transportation, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the United States Department of Agriculture, the United States Forest Service, FEMA, the Department of Defense, the United States Army Corps of Engineers, the United States Navy, and this is not a complete listing. The point is that there are a wealth of other agencies and federal resources that are called out in the NCP that are available to assist with responding to a discharge. Some other things worth noting is with respect to the first bullet item, it's very clear what those are. Safety, stabilize the situation, and ensure a timely response. And with respect to the second bullet, the framework includes steps such as investigate, classify the size and the type of the release, oversee cleanup efforts, where appropriate, determine if other political subdivisions could come in and take on the responsibility for oversight, and ensure prompt notification of affected natural trustees. Both of these items will be discussed in greater detail tomorrow. There are some other key positions, but the one I'd like to call out for you is the last bullet item, which is Appendix E to Part 300. This document compiles the general oil discharge response requirements into one appendix. The AG and other responders under the National Response System. So in other words, if you didn't want to have to read through the NCP and review all parts, you can go to Appendix E, and what you have here in this appendix is all that you need to know about the organizational structure and procedures for preparing for and responding to oil discharges. Okay, a few moments just delving a little bit deeper into the removal authority. Again, there's the Clean Water Act, Section 311C. Within this section, it highlights the general removal requirement that is there. We've mentioned it briefly. We'll talk about it tomorrow. But one thing I haven't said is whatever the OSC does do with respect to the 311C authority, that those actions have got to be done in accordance with the NCP or the National Contingency Plan. With respect to the second bullet item, this executive order implements the Oil Pollution Act by outlining emergency response procedures for managing spills of oil and hazardous materials in waters within the United States, and also requires that other federal agencies such as agriculture, commerce, defense, energy, and interior participate in contingency planning. And with respect to the third bullet item, we're going to talk about that in a little more detail, beginning with this slide. And the one thing that I would like to draw your attention to is the fourth bullet item. We're going to talk about natural resource trustees in a little bit detail, more detail, in the next couple of slides. And then the final bullet item, to determine when the removal is complete, we'll discuss that in greater detail tomorrow. This is perhaps one of the most vexing, most challenging issues that any OSC will have to grapple with, is when are things done? In other words, some people might refer to this as, when do you determine how clean is clean? Okay, I'd like to spend a few moments over the remaining slides talking about natural resources, and in particular, natural resource trustees. The involvement of natural resource trustees will vary with each region. So, for example, if you're west of the Rocky Mountains, you may find yourself dealing with a number of federal, state, local, tribal, and international trustees. And you may find similar situations in those locations east of the Rocky Mountains. What's so important about this is within the NCP, there are a number of shells. In other words, there are things that the OSC shall do with respect to natural resource trustees. For example, OSCs shall work with natural resource trustees in specific preparedness and response activities. Trustees shall provide timely advice concerning recommended actions with regard to trustee resources. And trustees shall coordinate certain activities they're responsible for, such as natural resource damage assessment activities, with the OSCs. So this isn't voluntary, rather these are specific things that both NCPs and trustees must do. And to give you a sense as to what natural resources are, they're pretty much anything that are held in trust by different entities, be it the United States, a particular state, an Indian tribe, a local government, or in some instances, a foreign government. So the important thing to note here is they're both physical and they're biological. And here is a listing of who the trustees are. At the federal level, it's the secretaries of Ag, Commerce, Defense, Energy, and Interior. And interestingly enough, EPA is a trustee in a very narrow way. The Resources and Ecosystem Sustainability, Tourist Opportunities, and Revived Economies of the Gulf Coast Act, also referred to as the Restore Act of 2012, identified EPA as a trustee for the Gulf Coast. The only situation that I'm aware of where EPA, along with the secretaries from these other agencies, enjoys a trustee role. Then you have the state, you have tribe, and you have others. And Jean, that brings me to the conclusion of this module.
Okay, great. So just a reminder, if you do have a question or comment for our presenters, you can use the Q&A window to type them up. We do have one or two that kind of came through, and I'll start reading through some of those, and if we get any more, we'll try to address them now. This first question is actually coming in from a participant that would like to know if they can estimate the amount of an oil spill by looking at the size of the sheen on surface water.
Gene, this is Doug. Region 2 here. I'll take that question. I have seen some estimators for determining the volume of an oil spill. It's based on the appearance of the sheen or the oil slick, and from that you kind of estimate the thickness of oil and then multiply it times the area. Well, the thing is, you can imagine in an oil spill it's a pretty dynamic situation. The slick itself is typically moving around by the wind or the water or the currents or whatever. So trying to get a uniform appearance is the first tricky part. You might have some like rainbow sheen on the sides and a thicker portion of the slick in the center of it. And then to try to estimate the you know, the square footage or acres or, you know, square meters of the area for each of those colors, you know, it becomes pretty tough to use any kind of appearance indication as an estimate of the volume. So, you know, I suppose under like laboratory or ideal conditions, you could come up with something that might be a fairly accurate estimate. But in the field and the angst and the chaos of a response to an oil spill, it's just something I personally have not seen used, and I think it'd be rather difficult to apply.
Gene, this is Earl. I would agree completely with Doug, and it becomes even more difficult when you're in a situation where you might have a river, and the spill is not directly into the river, but let's say it's to an area immediately joining in the river, and you've got episodic sheens developing along the bank line. Well, those sheens are no measure as to what may be in storage in the bank and is being chronically released to the river over time. So it is an extraordinarily difficult thing to do, and frankly, one that I, in my limited experience, I've never done before.
Okay, great. We have another participant that just shared a comment with you, and this is just a clarifying statement. One participant has commented that Natural Resource Try FYI, that the Natural Resource Trustees only include state, federal, and federally recognized tribes. That does not include local groups and cities.
That is correct.
Okay.
Natural Resource Trustees are identified in the NCP in particular, and those sections that were cited. And you have federal, state, tribal, and other, and NGOs, non-governmental organizations, or special interest groups are not designated trustees. Now, does that mean that those groups cannot enjoy one or more avenues into the process? Absolutely not. They might have opportunities given pre-existing relationships with federal, state, tribal entities to voice their concerns and have that carried into an incident. There's also the opportunity to speak directly with EPA and the like. So while they're not formally designated as trustees, they do nonetheless have ways of ensuring that their concerns and interests are brought forward.
Okay. Our next question comes in from a participant that says, the question is, EPA typically is the FOSC for inland spills, while the U.S. Coast Guard has an FOSC role in coastal marine spills. For coastal spills, what are EPA's specific roles?
That's an interesting question. EPA's roles would be to assist, well, first of all, the person who asked the correction is correct. The United States Coast Guard provides OSCs for those marine environments, while EPA provides OSCs for the inland environments. And in those instances where a marine spill may be such that the Coast Guard would request the assistance of EPA, we are available to assist them in roles that are compatible with our roles and responsibilities as an FOSC in inland areas. And there's also the opportunity for responsibility to move back and forth between EPA and Coast Guard. And so, for example, while a discharge may be in coastal waters, it may be such that the nature of the discharge, the proximity of the discharge to the shoreline, the availability of the resources are such that the Coast Guard will then pass on responsibility for that relief, that discharge to EPA. Greg, would you like to add anything to that?
Well, no, Earl, other than that, I think it more frequently goes the other way around, where an spill that originates in the inland zone might also impact the coastal zone, because that's where waters flow. And in which case, you know, EPA retains the FOSC role for that spill because it originates in the inland zone. But the idea, I think, is that we coordinate with the Coast Guard for those spills that are where it's not clear whether it's inland or coastal. We are likely to both show up and determine who is the appropriate FOSC, and then EPA may support the Coast Guard, the Coast Guard may support EPA in that response.
Yeah, and the specific part in the NCP regarding this is 300.120, and there is a discussion of that, and if you're interested in learning more about it.
Okay, great. We're going to take one more question, and then we'll carry on with the slides. This last question for the break asks, what is the magnitude of this spill to trigger OSC involvement versus it being handled at a local or regional level by a state agency? And
well,
I can repeat that if you need it.
Yeah, no, that's a very interesting question and one that challenges us in most, if not all, instances when we receive notice of a report through the NRC or the National Response Center. There is no minimum threshold, if you will, for whether or not we'll respond to a discharge. For example, and I hasten to add that this isn't true for all regions across the country. I'm speaking only in terms of Region 10, which is Alaska, Washington, Oregon, and Idaho. So, for example, do you have to have 50 gallons? Do you have to have 100 gallons? Do you have to have 200 gallons? No. What we look at is the overall setting for the discharge. We look at quantity, yes. We look at resources that are at risk. We consult with our partners, the federal trustees and states. We look at socioeconomic issues, all of those issues, many of which we'll discuss in greater detail during tomorrow's presentation. But suffice to say, there is not a minimum threshold, at least within Region 10, and we looked at the totality of the discharge in light of the environment, human, socioeconomic issues, the ability of first responders to respond, and to carry on a long-term cleanup action and the like. Doug, Greg, or Jim, would you like to add to that from your perspectives?
No, I think you've done well with that. I don't have any additions.
That sounds good, Earl.
Okay. We did have one person from EPA Region 7 that commented that for their region, they used the limit of 10,000 gallons as an automatic trigger, but they have discretion that they apply based on additional information for quantities that are spilled below that.
Wow. Okay. I'm sure that's the case. You know, this is Greg. If 10,000, some amount less than 10,000 gallon in a sensitive environment, I'm sure they would respond. They take into account, as Earl explained, all the factors involved to determine whether they need an FOSC presence at the site.
Okay, great. I think we'll conclude our portion of our question break right now, and let's go ahead and carry on with the presentation. But you guys can continue to submit your questions and comments from the participants at any time using the Q&A. We will take another break to take more questions and answers from the audience.
Okay. Okay, Earl, are we ready to move to the next module?
Yes, sir, we are.
Okay, we're going to talk about the trust fund. Is that you, Greg?
Yes, it is, Jim. I'm going to discuss the Oil Spill Liability Trust Fund. And what I'm going to do is also invite Doug Kadama to chime in aggressively in this section because he is actually one of our agency experts in the use of the Oil Spill Liability Trust Fund and leads, you know, coordination with the National Pollution Fund Center. So, Doug, if you would, please just insert yourself wherever you think appropriate in this presentation.
Okay, Greg, I will.
Okay, so the Oil Spill Liability Trust Fund, or the OSLTF, is the big pot of money. It's the big pile of money that is used to fund oil spill response, and that's to fund federal, and it can also fund state, tribal, or local entity response, local government entity response to oil spills, whether that's investigating oil spills to determine if they represent a discharge or substantial threat of discharge to navigable waters of the U.S., or initiating EPA or Coast Guard lead response to that spill and cleaning that spill up, or fulfilling our role to provide oversight and direction of a PRP lead spill. The Oil Spill Liability Trust Fund funds those efforts. And it also funds, very importantly, it also pays for uncompensated economic damages from the spill. And we'll talk more about that later. And it pays to initiate natural resource damage assessment for oil spills, which we will also talk about later. The Oil Spill Liability Trust Fund is used to fund spills from the very largest, such as the Deepwater Horizon spill that had costs applied to the Oil Spill Liability Trust Fund of approximately $619 million, to the very smallest, such as here in Idaho, if a vehicle were to end up in a canal and one of the Idaho hazmat teams responded under the direction of the OSC after notification through the National Response Center to put some boom in that canal to mitigate the migration of that oil downstream and where it might return again to the Snake River. Something like that, we may open the Oil Spill Liability Trust Fund for a couple thousand dollars.
Greg, you've got control of the slides there.
What?
You have control for advancing the slides.
Oh, yeah. Okay, thank you. All right. I'm under control. The Oil Spill Liability Trust Fund was authorized by the Oil Pollution Act of 1990 that Earl described. And it was authorized at a size of over $2 billion. The last I heard that it's at approximately $2.4 billion. And it was funded originally by funds were rolled into the Oil Spill Liability Trust Fund from other previously existing funds under the Clean Water Act, and I think the Safe Drinking Water Act, and the fund has since been augmented by a tax on a barrel tax on oil produced or imported into the United States. I think it's presently at 8 cents per barrel through 2016, and it is scheduled to go to 9 cents per barrel in 2017. The fund also receives money from costs recovered for expenditures against the fund, costs recovered from responsible parties, and from penalties that are assessed under the Oil Pollution Act and maybe, I think, in some cases, the Clean Water Act. There we go. And this is what the fund looks like. Looks like a big pie, with one small slice of it being the emergency fund, the rest of it being the ballast or the principal of the fund. The fund is so large to be able to sustain itself through interest received on the fund, and to be able to be there for the big one. And when we think of the big one, and we're thinking also in terms of costs for uncompensated damages. And these can be economic damages to fisheries. They can be economic damages to tourism, marinas, whatever. The cost for such economic damages can be enormous. And if they are not compensated by the responsible party, claimants, those who suffered the damages, can file claim against the Oil Spill Liability Trust Fund. And that's one reason why the fund has to be so large. but it also provides, very importantly, for the emergency fund. $50 million per year is set aside from the principal fund to fund emergency response or response to oil spill discharges or substantial threats of discharges. And that $50 million a year is what funds primarily the EPA and the Coast Guard responses.
Greg, I would just kind of interject this point. That's correct. It is $50 million a year. And during the time when the federal government was responding to Deepwater Horizon and the Enbridge oil spills, the National Pollution Fund Center did go to Congress and ask for an increase to that emergency fund to be able to cover the costs for those two extremely large responses by the federal government. So the Coast Guard, through the National Pollution Fund Center, does have the ability to go back to Congress and ask for additional funding beyond that $50 million per year.
Thank you, Doug. And that $50 million, I think it's for the most part used up on a yearly basis, but any excess will roll over from year to year.
Hey, Greg and Doug, could you spend just a moment describing the world of damages, what that includes?
Yeah, it includes economic damages, and it can be damages to any party. And I'm not, I don't have the language in front of me, but when we think of economic damages, large economic damages, we might think of damages to fisheries and livelihoods of people who rely on those fisheries. We might think of damages to tourism, as was experienced on the Gulf Coast. And if those damages can be quantified and substantiated, those people who suffered the damage are required first to apply for a compensation of those damages to the responsible party. If those damages are not compensated by the responsible party, they may then apply for compensation of those or reimbursement of those damages to the Oil Spill Liability Trust Fund.
Great, thank you.
All right. So the core mission of the NPFC is to administer the disbursement and ensure the proper use of the emergency fund. And they do this on a 24 hours a day, every day basis so that Coast Guard and EPA OSCs can immediately access the funding authority and start incurring costs to respond to discharges or to monitor or direct to discharges or response to discharges by responsible parties. The emergency fund is used by OSCs to cover expenses associated with investigating a discharge, with conducting EPA or Coast Guard lead response to the discharge, or providing oversight and direction to RPs with respect to the discharge. One more thing about claims, just going back, because I don't know if we'll talk about claims after this, following up, Earl, is that the OSC is not responsible for the claims. That's a process between the claimant, the responsible party, and the National Pollution Fund Center that administers the Oil Spill Liability Trust Fund. However, if you're an OSC on a spill and you see that there are damages, you see that there are oiled boats, for instance, or an oiled marina, you should give your OSLTF or MPFC case officer a heads up that there's likely to be claims, because they need to know that. They need to anticipate that there are going to be claims against the fund for that spill. Is that correct, Doug? Anything to add on that?
That sounds good, yep, for claims.
Okay. Okay, the Oil Spill Liability Trust Fund, or the fund, can be accessed directly by U.S. Coast Guard and EPA OSCs. They have immediate access to funding through through the online ceiling and number assignment processing system, or CANAPS. Here in Region 10, each individual EPA OSC can have assigned a password and access CANAPS directly, and they can immediately be provided up to $50,000 in approved ceiling to initiate response. Here in Region 10, we have four OSCs that maintain those passwords, because with all of the other passwords that we have to maintain, we thought it was not reasonable for every OSC to keep current with a CANAPS password. We have four OSCs that have CANAPS passwords and can access CANAPS immediately. And if another OSC who is on duty is responding, they know to contact one of those four who will open the fund for them. When you open the fund, it's a pretty simple process through CANAPS. You can get up to $50,000 approved immediately. If you need more than $50,000, which could be the case immediately if you have to initiate immediate salvage operations or something that's very costly, you would enter that amount into CANAPS. It will only give you up to $50,000, but the system will also contact the MPSC duty officer. And the MPSC also maintains a 24-hour duty officer rotation where somebody is on duty 24 hours a day. If for some reason you're not able to get online, you need access to the fund as an OSC, you can also telephone that duty officer, describe the situation, and he can enter your information and provide the ceiling. If you need over $50,000, you need to talk to your NPFC duty officer, and because the NPFC has fiduciary responsibility for the fund. They take very seriously their role in ensuring that the fund is being used properly, and that the fund is being used to address spills that meet the threshold criteria of the NCP. One of the things that I want to emphasize here is communication between the OSC and the MPFC case officer, and that can solve so many problems. We have seen certain occasions, I don't think it's happened for a while, where for some reason, the MPFC case officer has not felt that they've been getting adequate information to make the positive determination that this spill and this response meets the threshold criteria, and there's been problems for accessing additional money or accessing the fund at a ceiling that we request. But those problems are solved through communication. The OSC needs to be communicating with the case officer. And in order to get a ceiling approved above $50,000, they will have to talk to their case officer. The case officer is notified through the CANAPS system of a request over $50,000, and they should be contacting the OSC. But the OSC needs to be also reaching out to that case officer, describing the situation. They will do that as soon as possible in distributing their initial poll rep, but they should also be reaching out and making sure that the NPSC understands that this is indeed a discharge that meets the threshold criteria and what the circumstances are.
Yeah, Greg, I would just add that not only do we access the fund for conducting removal actions, but we can also use this funding to do a preliminary assessment, to just learn more about a spill and determine if it does meet those criteria for us to initiate response and conduct a removal.
Yeah, that's a great point, Doug, and I'll just expand upon that a little bit. Because in the inland zone, and particularly here in Idaho, we have a lot of highways that follow rivers, and that's how you get around here in Idaho. And we have a lot of tank truck traffic that sometimes ends up in the ditch, maybe on the other side of the river. We don't know. They may have lost their contents of a saddle tank. They may have lost a pup or a larger amount into that ditch. We don't know if it presents a threat of discharge or not to the river on the other side. Say it's the Clearwater River. We have to go and investigate that. And the costs for conducting that investigation are funded by the Oil Spill Liability Trust Fund. We'll open the fund. will go to support our travel, maybe to support a mobilization of the START contractor. And those are legitimate costs under the Oil Spill Liability Trust Fund, up until the point where we decide that, no, you know, there is hardly anything here. It's not, does not present, we've got some contaminated soil, but it does not present a threat of discharge to the river. We're going home. Then we, you know, have to stop charging to the federal project number or to the Oil Spill Liability Trust Fund. Okay? All right, so I've referenced threshold criteria. When you open the fund, like we just discussed, you may do that to investigate a response. Oh, thanks. I keep forgetting to advance this slide. But in order to continue the response, you need to make a positive determination that you've met the threshold criteria for accessing the fund. First is that the substance involved is an oil, and that is usually pretty straightforward, but not always the case. You know, oil is oil of any kind, except if it's not oil, and sometimes it's not clear. You know, for example, I responded to a spill from a rail tank car of ethanol. It was just labeled as ethanol, not E95 or something. But we all know that ethanol, unless it's food grade, is denatured with gasoline. We justified that we were responding to this spill of ethanol by the fact that we were really responding to the gasoline content of that was in the marsh. So we fulfilled that requirement that we were responding to an oil. The second and more difficult criteria to describe is that there is a discharge or substantial threat of discharge into navigable waters or adjoining shorelines. If it's directly into the water, that's not so difficult, but frequently here in the inland zone in particular, we have spills that are sometimes difficult to determine. We have spills that are to a ditch, a dry ditch, that may eventually lead to the Malad River, which empties into the Snake, which empties into the Columbia River, but it could be several miles. The ditch is currently dry. Sometimes it flows with water after rain events. Does that spill represent a discharge or substantial threat of discharge to waters of the U.S.? Well, sometimes it's a difficult call to make, but the OSC has to be on scene and has to connect the dots. It's not sufficient to say that, well, this spill is within one quarter mile of the Malad Creek, therefore presents a substantial threat of discharge. No, you got to connect the dots. You got to say, this spill is in the ditch. There's free product in the ditch. We're anticipating rain, possible rain within the next 48 hours, which could cause a flow in that ditch, which discharges to the Malad Creek, which discharges to the Snake River. You should be able to describe that and should do that in your poll rep one, or do that as quickly as possible in your conversations with the MPSC case officer. And you need to know in your own mind that you indeed are meeting that threshold criteria. And the third is removal actions must be, or removal costs, I guess more importantly, must be consistent with the NCP, as Earl earlier described. And that should seem like a no-brainer, but what would be removal actions or costs that are not consistent with the NCP? Well, just speculating, it possibly could be costs that other people are charging to your FPN, whether it's regional management, whether it's headquarters management. If there are people that are charging to your federal project number and that you, as the OSC, don't know precisely what they're charging for, that's in support of the response, I'm just speculating, but there may be some problems there. I think it's important. The point there is that it's important for OSCs to know who's charging to your FPN, to ensure that what they're charging for is consistent with the response and consistent with actions per the NCP. Anything to add there?
Well, along the same lines, Greg, would be to unknowingly or unwittingly fund a natural resource trustee to go out and to perform NRDA, natural resource damage assessment activities. You can bring on board a federal or state or a tribal trustee to assist, provided they're doing so within the scope of your interests. But were they to be outside of that, wanting to come in and seeking funding similar to someone else unrelated to your FPN, that would be another example that would be inconsistent with the NCP, perhaps.
Yeah, that's a good point. I've actually got a slide on that later on, and we'll talk about that in a little detail, because sometimes it's hard to figure out what is support of the OSC by a natural resource trustee per, you know, complying with the emergency consultation under the Endangered Species Act, and what's a natural resources damage assessment. All right, so Earl alluded to one of the great tools that are available to OSCs under the Oil Spill Liability Trust Fund and is administered by the NPFC, the National Pollution Fund Center. We're real acronym rich in this segment. We got NPFC, we got OSLTF, we have PRFA, we have FPN, Federal Project Number, NRDA, Natural Resource Damage Assessment, PRFA. So if you know all those already, you're going to pass the test at the end of this. But I'll try not to just use the acronym here. But the pollution removal funding authorizations are available to the OSC, federal or you know, EPA or Coast Guard OSC, to essentially hire other government agencies, whether that's a state agency or tribal or local agencies who can provide support in conducting the response. And sometimes that is actual response support. For instance, here in Boise, Idaho, we have the regional office of the Bureau of Reclamation, and they have a lot of resources for work that they do in dams and dam safety throughout the Northwest, and I've used them through PRFA to install monitoring wells, to install LNAPL recovery systems, to install permeable reactive barriers at sites where we were conducting the response fund lead. But more typically, we might fund other federal agencies to help us with meeting our responsibilities for emergency consultation under the Endangered Species Act. And this is something we do a lot in the Northwest, maybe not so much in other parts of the country, but essentially any spill to river system here in the Northwest involves ESA emergency consultation because of endangered Chinook salmon or critical habitat. And when we talk to the Department of Interior and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service about emergency consultation, the first thing they do, they know the process, and they are very glad to give us help, but the first thing they do is put their hand out and they say, give us a PRFA to fund that effort. And that's legitimate costs supporting the response. We do the same thing with tribes. If we need support for a tribal cultural resources specialist because we're digging up soil, we can fund that under a PRFA with the tribe, and I've done that several times, particularly with the Nez Perce tribe here. And as I said before, federal trustees conducting natural resources damage assessment can access the fund directly, as well as claimants. So, oil spill assessment is appropriately funded under a federal project number by the Oil Spill Liability Trust Fund. to evaluate whether or not a discharge or substantial threat of discharge meets that threshold criteria, and to evaluate the magnitude and the severity of the spill. We can open up the Oil Spill Liability Trust Fund to go out and assess the spill. If we determine that the spill does not indeed represent a threat of discharge to navigable waters of the U.S., the cost for conducting the assessment up to that point where we make that determination, and then any other, I guess, demobilization costs or whatever, are still legitimate costs applied to the Oil Spill Liability Trust Fund. Likewise, if we were to respond to a spill, say it was characterized as used oil recycler went over and dumped his contents dumped something into the creek. We later learned that the oil was, in fact, we respond to the used oil. We were out there using our authority, spending money to put out boom or whatever. We later learned when we've recovered some oil and are characterizing it for disposal that it is indeed contaminated, that it exceeds or fails for lead or has PCB content or chlorinated solvents in it, and it is, in fact, a hazardous waste. At that point, we would cut off continued funding under the Oil Spill Liability Trust Fund because we learned that what we have, in fact, is a hazardous waste that is properly funded under CERCLA. And I think we're going to talk more about this in another segment as well. But those costs up to that point are still legitimately funded under the Oil Spill Liability Trust Fund because we were responding to what we knew at the time was an oil until we learned otherwise. Is that correct, Doug?
Yes, it is, and I will be addressing this more under the oil mixtures or mixed spills. Yep.
Okay, excellent. So oil spill response conducted by EPA, the Coast Guard, actually hiring contractors to put out boom, to recover oil, to protect water inlets. If we were doing that, those are all, of course, legitimate costs, as well as our costs for overseeing or directing the PRP lead efforts in a spill. Okay, this is the NRDA discussion, and it's really not that big of a deal because it happens very rarely, and OSCs are not responsible for natural resources damage assessment. In fact, we have no authority to conduct or oversee natural resources damage assessment. But what can happen and has happened here sometimes is that we have trustee agency representatives on site to help us fulfill our requirements for Endangered Species Act consultation or emergency consultation to ensure that our response actions aren't making things worse with respect to endangered species or critical habitat, such as if we might have salmon reds, salmon spawning grounds in the Clearwater River where we're conducting a response. Those people might also be initiating their responsibilities to conduct natural resource damage assessment, whether that's counting fish kill, or it could be involve a lot more, such as identifying these spawning reds, conducting sediment sampling of the reds, conducting fish tissue sampling. This is information that they need quickly, that they need on an emergency basis. That's why the NRDA initiation is funded under the emergency fund. But it's not a process that we're responsible for. However, it's a process that will happen concurrently with our response, and it might involve the same people, and they may request assistance from us for conducting the sampling. They may need boats, they may need sampling equipment, they may need start contractors to conduct the sampling. Well, that's a tough call. They need, we're not supposed to really support that effort, but typically the cost, if it's an RP, if there's a viable RP, the cost will all be paid by the RP, so, it's a tough call. We're not supposed to be doing that, though. And you have to try to keep those costs separate, even if it's all part of the same, we're sharing some of the same resources. You got anything more to add to that, Earl?
Well, it is a murky field, Greg. The one thing that I would say is, for example, you're on the Clearwater or the Locksaw, and you had aerial assets. You had a helicopter, and you had to go from point A to point B. Well, if you happen to have a tribal or a federal trustee there, I would see no difficulty with allowing them to share the asset to go along with you on the ride. It's not as if you're doing it for their benefit, rather you're doing it for yours, and you're just maximizing the joint use of resources. But I think you've captured it well. It's one of those murky areas. The other thing you need to be mindful of is trustees come into an incident not only with their trustee roles, if you will, but they also have their roles and their day job as resource managers. And it's that can oftentimes be a challenge when they start to wear two hats or three hats along with you. And so you also need to be mindful of their role with respect to supporting your response to an incident, trustees' roles with respect to a natural resource trustee, and then roles with respect to their day job as a resource manager. And at times it can be challenging.
All right. There we go, enforcement and cost recovery. Cost recovery, you know, EPA OCs have, well, I assume Coast Guard OCs as well, have authority to issue orders to Clean Water Act orders to compel a response to spills. It happens, I think, pretty rarely for oil spills as compared to CERCLA. And we've done it once here, and I think it was mostly a political imperative than actually necessitated by what was going on in the field. But typically, to working with responsible parties in our enforcement mode as OSCs in Region 10, we issue what is called a Notice of Federal Interest, which is just a letter signed by the OSC that says, you are a potentially responsible party for this spill. This is, these are your responsibilities. So long as you fulfill these responsibilities, my role as the OSC will be oversight or oversight and direction. If you fail to fulfill these responsibilities or do them in a timely or adequate manner, then EPA may take over this response and you'd be liable for those costs. And that is a pretty effective tool, and that's just signed by the OSC. Whenever we show up at a spill, we give them this letter or this notice of federal interest. OSCs should, if the RP is not clear, make initial attempts to identify who is the responsible party and include that in information that you're providing to the MPSC case officer. You should be providing that information in your poll rep or initial poll rep. If it is very difficult to identify an RP and you don't have the resources to be able to do that, the MPSC can and has on occasion been able to provide assistance and send somebody out there to help you with that effort. It's ultimately their responsibility and their job to identify and pursue cost recovery against responsible parties. And they do a very good job at that. What they need from you as the OSC, you have to help them set up the elements for cost recovery. You have to identify RPs. You have to typically provide RPs a response to or an opportunity to conduct the response and to conduct it timely and adequately. You have to track costs, and you have to provide a cost summary and supporting cost documentation to the MPSC for them to complete cost recovery. You also need to notify the MPSC when the removal is complete, and you do that in a final poll rep so as they know when the start of the statute of limitations is. Anything to add on that?
No, you've got it.
Okay, let's go to some fun and games here. We have some scenarios, and you're going to be able to insert a response. Participants are going to be able to insert a response to these scenarios. So I will read out the scenario. You'll have a minute or so to think about it and respond, and then we'll discuss the response. All right, scenario one. All that remains of an abandoned oil field are three waste pits filled with oily waste. The pits drain to a nearby wetland, and I think that top picture shows it pretty well. EPA will close the pits due to the frequent oil discharges to the wetland and harm to migratory waterfowl. Well, we don't even have to, you know, establish that there's harm to migratory waterfowl. If there's discharge, then we meet the criteria for being able to do what needs to be done there. Pits 1 and 2 are filled with oil and water, while pit 3 is known to have F001 waste. And that would be, that's a RCRA waste. It's the nonspecific spent solvent. Can these pits be closed? The OSC wants to access the Oil Spill Liability Trust Fund to do this work. Can these pits be closed using the Oil Spill Liability Trust Fund? And you have three choices below. Yes, no, or no vote. And I see we got most responses in, and almost everybody got the right correct answer. The correct answer is that pits 1 and 2 may be used. The Oil Spill Liability Trust Fund may be used to close. But you have to separate out pit number 3 because it involves a hazardous waste. And if substance is a hazardous waste, it's not an oil, and it cannot be funded using the Oil Spill Liability Trust Fund. So unfortunate for the OSC here, because he's going to have to open two funding sources, one from the Oil Spill Liability Trust Fund, one from CERCLA, and track costs separately and essentially conduct two separate actions here in order to clean up these three pits. Any comments on that, Doug or Earl?
No, you're spot on, Greg.
Okay, scenario two. We have leaking underground gasoline tank near Mojave, California. Look at that house. That's beautiful.
That's my retirement home we're going to build soon.
And this leaking UST has contaminated 16 drinking water wells in a nearby subdivision. Continue on. The nearest navigable water is more than 5 miles away. Well, this is the desert. Maybe it's more than 50 miles away. Can the OSLTF, Oil Spill Liability Trust Fund, be used to temporarily provide bottled water to these residents so that they have a clean drinking water source while we or somebody else continue to characterize this groundwater contamination and deal with this leaking underground storage tank? And the answers are coming in.
And remember, you just simply click on the circle to the left of the answer that best matches your reply.
Well, looks like we have a good number of answers, and about 70% of them are correct. No, we cannot use the Oil Spill Liability Trust Fund because, one, we do not seem to have a clear nexus to navigable waters of the United States. We do not meet that threshold criteria. We're out in the desert. There, the creek is 5 miles away. We don't have apparently an overland discharge pathway. We have a contaminated aquifer. It's unlikely to extend 5 miles to that creek, and we therefore do not have a nexus to navigable waters of the U.S. Now, I'm going to change this one up a little bit. What if the contaminated groundwater plume discharges to a creek right on the other side of that that house? That we have BTEX constituents. This is a gasoline discharge, and we have BTEX constituents in that creek from the groundwater discharge from this leaking UST that exceed applicable water quality standards. We determine that we indeed do have a nexus or a discharge to navigable waters of the United States, and can go in and do what needs to be done to mitigate that that discharge. You know, we might be installing, in this case, air sparging, clean up groundwater. We might be installing a permeable reactive barrier to strip those contaminants before they enter the creek. If that were the case, and part in the state, let's say the state, California, asked us to also provide bottled water to these residents, could we then provide that bottled water? I think we have an overwhelming response of yes. What would you say the answer to that modified scenario would be, Doug?
Well, you know, we can address the discharge or the threat of a discharge to surface waters, and that is the limitation that we're kind of faced with here. If we can somehow say that providing bottled water is going to prevent the discharge from occurring or the substantial threat of a discharge from occurring in the future, then maybe we could, but this is not really a public health response action that we're taking here. It is strictly limited to cleaning up the oil that may get into the surface water.
Yeah, I'd say this is a difficult one because all of our actions and all of our costs using the Oil Spill Liability Trust Fund under the Clean Water Act and OPA have to be directed towards investigating, mitigating a discharge to navigable waters of the U.S. Now, like you said, if we could link providing bottled water to that effort, then it would be an appropriate cost. If, however, it's strictly to provide a clean drinking water source for the residents and strictly a public health response that we're doing in providing that bottled water, that might be a questionable cost.
You know, Greg and Doug, another way of looking at this is perhaps if to some extent the cleanup action had an impact on the drinking water wells. In other words, you had to sort of adopt those wells and furtherance of your action. That might provide some means to address the issue of providing end-of-tap treatments or bottled water. But I would agree with both of you. Absent some nexus, I wouldn't see it happening.
Just to comment on that, if I may, Earl, this is Jim. The installation of at the tap treatment is, which is being discussed, is not something that happens instantly like a response to a spill. So there's opportunity to discuss this with the National Pollution Fund Center case officers and attorneys, and good opportunity to get a final decision on what they'll fund and what they want before you embark on that.
There you go, Jim. That is a beautiful answer. Communication is the key and solves a lot of these problems.
And thus, That is why Jim is the sage elder. Another thing to keep in mind is Greg had mentioned, you know, perhaps a water body on the other side of the hill. It's possible that the plume may take several years before it, you know, would then emanate out of the bank, and you would have that nexus with surface water. So that's another interesting twist on this situation, is may not happen instantaneously. It may take quite some time.
All right, good point, Earl. One more scenario. Scenario three. A tractor trailer wreck releases 8,000 gallons of red dyed diesel fuel to a dry roadside ditch. Let's say that this ditch is in Idaho and it's on Highway 12 adjacent to the Lacsaw River, but the tractor trailer released these 8,000 gallons into the cut bank side, the uphill side of the ditch. On the other side, the highway drops down to the river. But there are no culverts. It's a dry ditch. Could the OSLTF, Oil Spill Liability Trust Fund, be used to clean up these diesel-contaminated soils? And we'll let the responses come in. Well, looks like we've got almost the majority of the responses are maybe. Close second is yes, and I would say that both of those are correct. It's a definite maybe, but certainly the Oil Spill Liability Trust Fund could be used to mobilize and investigate, which is probably what you would have to do in this case. Investigate the spill and collect information to determine if that spilled product in the ditch on the other side of the river does present a threat, a substantial threat of discharge to the river. Could it migrate through that road prism and enter the river at some point? As Earl says, if it's left unremediated, that point, some point could be next year or the year after. And that's a call that that the OSC has to make, and it's not always obvious. But if we determine that no, there really wasn't 8,000 gallons, it's not that big a deal. The basalt bedrock kind of slants the other, goes into the hill. I don't think it's going to make it to the river. Then we can charge those costs for investigating that, but after we make that determination, we go home and we don't charge any more to that site. Anything to add there?
Again, Greg, you're spot on. It's very challenging where you have a mixed scenario, the same incident up on the Lock Solve, which, for those of you who are familiar with the state, it's a federally designated wild and scenic river, and it's the roads constructed in a very narrow V-shaped valley, and literally when Greg said on one side you've got a cut bank, on the next side the road goes straight down to the river about 40 feet, and the shoulder might be only a couple of 3 feet in size, and so if you lose product to the cut bank, within 24, 36, or 48 hours, you would probably witness sheens. And they're episodic. In other words, they're not continual, but they're episodic, but they're at predictable areas. And in this particular instance, if you were to go out and conduct your investigation and you find out that it's on a portion of the roadway that was blasted, the slant of the rock is in bank, not towards the bank, and any residual product has, filled the various fractures. And for all practical purposes, is after some point, no longer releasing to the river. And so what you have here is a potential source, if you will, but based upon your investigation, you conclude that it will likely not discharge. Well, in that instance, it's a torturous path to get to that point, but at some point in working with your case officer, you're going to have to wrap that up, because these things ideally do not go on in perpetuity, a couple of months, maybe a few years, but they don't go on forever.
All right, thank you. I think that we discussed the answer, and it's time for questions.
Okay, well, just a reminder, we have reached 2:41 p.m. Eastern. We've got just under 1 hour and 20 minutes left for the remainder of our time. I'm going to take a short break here, about 4 minutes, to try to go through some of the questions that are coming in. We have a lot of comments that are coming in, a lot of clarifying statements. We've been trying to respond back throughout the presentation, so thank you for these comments. Keep them coming. I'm going to start reading, though, through some of the questions that our participants have put in. One of our participants asks, they were under the impression that the OSC only had access to the OSLTF fund with an amount of, it looks like, $5,000 initially in an emergency.
50,
is this
000.
Correct?
No, that's not correct. It's
$50,000.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
You can access through CANAPS, you can access up to $50,000 immediately without any other approval.
Okay. I have another participant that wants to know, is there other web-based training for, quote, other federal agencies on all of the administrative process and paperwork?
I am not aware
of it. The Fund Center does have a website with some of their procedures, so that might be a good reference to look into, but I would contact the Fund Center for other federal agencies to directly access the fund.
Okay. I do have a participant that commented on terms of CG and EPA response relationship. They just wanted to go on and mention that EPA, in their role on RRT, may review and approve requests by CG, FOSC, for the use of applied response technologies, and that includes cleanup agents for the use on offshore oil spills. And this was a comment that I think came in on a previous module, but I just wanted to start reading some of these out, because a lot of them have been really great comments that have come in.
Yeah, that's correct. That's just, I think, and we'll probably talk about that in other modules, but there are certain response technologies that require approval of the RRT, including use of dispersants.
Okay. We have a participant that is brought up clarification, and this is on an OSC role, which is to coordinate with the NRDAR efforts, for example, air operations and boat operations, and these need to be coordinated so there are no conflicts. It's good to have an NRDAR liaison to coordinate with those efforts within the unified command if staff resources are available. I don't know if any of you guys have worked like that or can comment on that.
I think it's an excellent suggestion. We are supposed to help coordinate those efforts, as the NCP says, even though we're not responsible for those efforts, and they should be coordinated within a single command structure if possible, and to have a specialist or technical specialist help facilitate that coordination and report up through the incident command, I think, is an excellent idea.
Yep.
Yeah, and in fact, that's required by the NCP. And for those of you who are interested, this is a shameless plug. We've got a Natural Resource Trustee webinar coming up. But per the NCP, there are specific requirements with respect to trustee responsibilities to OSC. And one of those is, if you have multiple trustees, is to designate a lead trustee to serve as the focal point for coordination between NRDA activities and response activities.
Okay. We do have a few questions that actually were brought up relative to the scenarios that you guys were walking through. And I'm just going to read through a couple of the ideas. And these were just questions that the participants brought up, and they wanted to know if they should be taken into consideration. So one of our participants wants to know if cost sharing can be employed in the first scenario.
Well, this is Greg. Like I said, you've got to develop two tracking systems to track costs. One, for those costs associated with that pond number three that includes circle hazardous waste, and one for the other two ponds that include oil discharge. And if you have, say, a single ERS contract or a single START contractor out there monitoring these activities, you've got to come up with a way for splitting those costs. And whatever way you come up with, whether it's actual, tracking of time and equipment usage on each of those ponds, or whether it's just a percentage based on volume of material, you've got to just be able to justify it. And any of those ways can work. You can develop a cost-sharing mechanism that as long as it makes sense, should be adequate. You'd have to probably discuss that with your case officer and, contracting officer.
And can you comment if most state LUST trust funds will provide funding through the insurance funding of underground storage tanks? I think this might have referred to the second scenario, but I'm not sure.
Yes, they should. I know in Idaho, the LUST fund would be an appropriate funding source for responding to leaking underground storage tank.
Yeah, in Idaho, isn't there an insurance entity that is supported by the industry?
Well, there's the Idaho Petroleum Storage Tank Fund that is an insurance fund that is voluntary. Not everybody buys into it, but it's pretty cheap.
All right.
We also have two other questions on the last scenario, and that's just if these factors should be considered. One of the participants wanted to know what the soil type was and if that should be brought in. And then another participant wanted to know what would you do if you had a forecast for heavy precipitation in the scenario?
Oh, those are all factors that you need to there's a whole lot of factors. It's possible to probably describe them all, because for each site there will be new factors that the OSC needs to consider in determining the nature of the emergency and determining, in fact, if there is indeed a discharge or substantial threat of discharge to navigable waters of the U.S. And one of those might be precipitation. There's rain coming. There's going to be water flowing in this ditch. It's going to push this petroleum out to the creek and to the river. And certainly the soil type. This is a porous soil. The 80,000 gallons of oil spilled into this ditch is going to migrate quickly through the road prism to the other side and discharge to the river. Those are factors you need to consider.
Right. Now, it's also important to note that the OSC is not standing alone. Rather, I suspect you would have a unified command scenario here where you would have federal, state, and the RP, or federal, state, tribal, and the RP, and then you'd have an entire structure beneath those persons. And so the needed expertise to interpret the site-specific conditions, be it meteorological or soil or critical habitat or whatnot, could all be brought in to assist unified command or the incident commander with making these types of determinations.
Okay, we've got just a couple of other comments just in general from other participants, and I just want to read these ones out loud. One of our participants mentioned that there is a similar issue that can come up with law enforcement. Fish and wildlife law enforcement agents might be investigating violations of the Migratory Bird Treaty Act and or the Endangered Species Act. So EPA and the U.S. CG might not be the only ones investigating an incident. So I just wanted to kind of bear that in mind when you're looking at a site.
Yeah, good point. And those efforts, like NRDA, should be coordinated.
Right.
So we aren't getting in each other's way.
Right, and the EPA has its own criminal investigators as well who may be out there. But that's correct. The law enforcement is a component of the unified command structure, or is often a component.
And we have one other final comment here, and they mentioned that we often help advise the FO SC on resources at risk, ways to reduce impacts to fish and wildlife resources. You don't always need to have the Endangered Species Act nexus to bring in that expertise. New FOSCs might want to know that. The instructors, they feel that you guys were focusing on ESA consultations, so they just wanted to bring that idea forward.
That's a good point. I'm glad they did.
Okay. Well, I think let's go ahead and kind of carry on with the presentation. Again, we're at 2:51. I apologize. It took a little bit longer, but we had some really great comments and observations there. And I'll go ahead and ask you guys if you can carry on with the presentation.
Sure. This is Doug, and we're going into our third segment here on what is oil. Well, you know, what is oil? I think I know what it is, and you probably think you know what it is. But, you know, oil is a general term, and it's used to describe a wide variety of natural substances of plant, animal, or mineral origin, as well as, you know, a range of synthetic compounds that we have manufactured these days. But, you know, for this course, each type of oil has a specific characteristics which influence its behavior when spilled, and then the resulting effects that it has biologically, environmentally, and then the efficiency of the cleanup as well. So what we're going to do is we're going to look at some of the definitions that we come across in the federal regulations and statutes. This first one, it's found in the National Contingency Plan, and that is kind of our playbook where we find the limits and the responsibilities and how to use our authority in conducting responses to oil discharges. Now, this definition in the NCP comes straight from the Clean Water Act, and it says that an oil is an oil of any kind in any form. Well, that's not real helpful, right? I mean, it just a circuitous definition. It's saying an oil is an oil. So, well, here we go. It's an oil of any kind in any form. Now it's getting a little more helpful. It's including, but not limited to, petroleum. I think I know what that is. Fuel oil, I know what that is. Sludge, well, all right, I think I know what that is. Oil refuse, well, I haven't refused or disposed of a lot of oil, so I'm not sure what that is, or oil mixed with waste other than dredge spoil. All right, so we're getting some examples here, but so far it's not real helpful. So let's kind of look elsewhere here. We'll look at the Oil Pollution Act. Now, why would we look there? That's where our source of funding to conduct oil removals is going to come from. So if we look at the Oil Pollution Act, we kind of get that same core definition here. It's oil of any kind in any form. You know, again, that's not real helpful. And then it's got some of these same examples. It's got petroleum, fuel oil, sludge, oil refuse, oil mixed with other wastes other than dredge spoil. And now it's telling us what it does not include. Well, it doesn't include petroleum, including crude oil or any fraction thereof that's listed as a Superfund hazardous substance. So we kind of have that same Clean Water Act definition, but now they're saying, but for funding purposes, if it's listed as a CERCLA hazardous substance, we're not going to help you with the oil fund. You got to go to Superfund there. So far, that's what we're getting. Now we're going to go to another place. We'll go to the Oil Pollution Prevention Regulations that houses the Spill Prevention Control and Countermeasure Regulations, as well as EPA's Facility Response Plan regulations. And here we go again. We got this same definition. It's oil means oil of any kind in any form. I think they're getting pretty adamant about that statement now. It's anything that could be an oil. But now the examples get a little bit different. It's fats and oils or greases of animal, fish, and marine mammal origin, vegetable oils. All right, so now it's not just petroleum. It's not just fuel oils. It's animal fats and vegetable oils. And then they've got in here the synthetic oils, mineral oils, and then some of these other examples that we've seen before, the oil refuse oil mixed with waste and other than dredged spoil. Now, also in that oil pollution prevention regulation, there is a definition for non-petroleum oils. Now, you know, I think I know what a petroleum oil is. Now we're going to learn what a non-petroleum oil is. So it's anything that's not petroleum-based. Okay, I can get that. So again, it's these fats, oils, greases of non-petroleum nature, basically animals, fishes, marine mammals, from seeds, nuts, fruits, kernels. So, all right, we're getting some pretty good examples here as to what they are, but, you know, not really a definition. You know, you go to Webster's, you want something defined. You want to know exactly what it is, and really what we're getting, it's oil of any kind in any form. That's the common phrase. And, you know, EPA did that because it is a general term. It is so hard to capture an exact definition that gives us the flexibility we need to address these discharges of oil. So, you know, the agency has defined it very broadly in an all-inclusive and kind of comprehensive way. We don't have any EPA list of what, you know, what is an oil or what constitutes an oil. The agency has given a little bit of guidance about it. And, you know, I can just kind of review what the agency has said. And I think you'll agree that no matter what kind of oil you're thinking about, these are some of the characteristics that you think of when the term oil comes to be. You know, it has limited water solubility. Well, that sounds about right. If it has, it has a relatively cohesive mass upon being discharged to a surface water. You know, you can see it as this mass either upon or in the water body. It has the potential for leaving a residue and being detected in the water body. That sounds right. It has the ability to be removed from the waters as well as the adjoining shorelines using available technologies. Now, the other thing that comes to mind with oils is that, you know, it has a variety of adverse environmental effects. It has it can harm to wildlife through contact with the sheens or the films of oil. It can have toxic effects on aquatic animals and plants from these sheens, as well as the films, the sludges, the emulsions, and the soluble fractions of the oil that are dissolved in the water. And, you know, one of the main things, it just has this adverse aesthetic effect. I mean, it just fouls the shorelines and the beaches, and it coats everything. It can asphyxiate fish, and benthic life, can drown waterfowl, and it can cause fish kills due to the increase in the biological oxygen demand placed on the water body. Now, specific gravity is not a factor in determining whether it's an oil or not, though. And, you know, as we said before, Clean Water Act hazardous substances are not oils. Now, one thing we should go over as well is, you know, what is not an oil? And coal tar waste from a former manufacturing gas plant is not an oil. We would address that using our Superfund authorities and funding mechanisms. The confusing part is that if you have coal tar product that you could purchase in commerce today, that would be an oil. But the waste from these former manufactured gas plants, that is not an oil. Along the same lines, it's creosote. Creosote waste from wood treatment facilities would be addressed using our Superfund authorities and funding. But creosote that you would purchase, that is, you know, product that you could get in commerce today, that would be considered an oil. Now, tires, although they're largely consist of oil, unless they're burning, tires by themselves are not considered an oil. First, you know, they're solid, so they're not going to flow. But if they are burning, and from the heat of the burning tires through pyrolysis, They're melting the tires and generating liquid oil that's coming out of the pile of burning tires. That oil being discharged from the burning tires is considered an oil. Tires are not, but when they're burning and through pyrolytic action they create oil, that oil is considered something that we can respond to using our OPA authorities and funding. And then, as we mentioned before, CERCLA hazardous substances and those Clean Water Act listed hazardous substances, those are definitely not oils. And natural gas is not an oil. The other thing that may be a little confusing is that natural gas distillate, that distillate that is a liquid at normal temperatures and pressures, that would be considered an oil that we can respond to. But the gas that goes out into the atmosphere creates huge fire hazard. That is not an oil. Now we're going to move on to the CERCLA petroleum exclusion. And basically, the definitions in CERCLA are defining what a hazardous substance is. So from the CERCLA perspective, what they're doing is they're excluding petroleum. So it's kind of a weird way of reading these things, but petroleum is defined not to be a hazardous substance or a pollutant or contaminant. And what they're doing here is they're just saying that the term hazardous substance does not include petroleum, including crude oil, or any fraction of crude oil, unless it is specifically designated as a hazardous substance. And the term hazardous substance does not include natural gas liquids, liquefied natural gas, synthetic gas used for fuel. So this petroleum exclusion is just kind of worded funny if you go to Superfund and look up the exclusion itself, because it's talking about the term hazardous substances and what's excluded from that. Now, when you come to the petroleum exclusion, the term petroleum does include hazardous substances that are normally mixed with or added to the crude oil at the refinery. So anything that's added to that crude oil or petroleum manufactured at the refinery, anything coming up to the refinery and included at the refinery, even if they're hazardous substances, that is considered a petroleum and would be excluded from Superfund. However, once it's left the refinery, it's out in general commerce, if through its normal use there's an increase in concentration of hazardous substances that kind of contaminate that petroleum, the exclusion from Superfund no longer applies, and if those hazardous substances are of high enough levels, then it would be now considered a CERCLA hazardous substance. So what does this mean for the OSC or the on-scene coordinator that's responding to oil spills? You cannot use Superfund to respond to a crude oil spill, even if there's been benzene in that crude oil. And you cannot use OPA to address an oil-based pesticide spill or a mixed waste spill. And then you can find more information about this petroleum exclusion on EPA's national website. You can't copy down this link. Just kind of go to the EPA website and use their search function there. Now, I want to talk a little bit about mixed substances. And, you know, OPA excludes the use of the oil fund for addressing CERCLA hazardous substances. But, you know, in the definitions, we specifically saw that oil includes oils mixed with waste other than dredge spoil. So we know dredge spoil's out of it. They kept telling us that, going over and over again. But EPA kind of had to come up with a position on how are we going to address these mixed substances. And so we did develop a mixed substances spill. It's kind of a position paper on how we're going to address these things, but it's really meant for the emergency situation where the OSC is going to have very limited information. And so when there's oil with a minor amount of a hazardous substance in the oil, EPA is going to use the primary threat posed by the material that's being spilled or discharged to determine our authority. If the concentrations by themselves of a hazardous substance wouldn't meet the eligibility criteria for an OSC to activate Superfund and conduct a Superfund removal action, then we're going to, at first, consider the material and oil and use our Clean Water Act authorities and oil funding to address this. See, it's basically the OSCs need to make these kind of swift field determinations, and there's very little information available to us when you first arrive on scene, and the chaos of the response and everything that's going on. So what the OSC is going to have to do is just to go to that readily available information. Go to the responsible party, whether there's, you know, someone who's informed about the material that was spilled, or if it's just a truck driver, or, you know, trying to get some information from, you know, the spiller themselves, or the states or the locals themselves may have some information about the material that's been spilled. If the source is truly unknown, then we'll use the behavior of the material and observe the adverse environmental effects. You know, I went through some of those characteristics about, you know, how it behaves. You know, it's not very water soluble. It's got this cohesive mass. You know, those are the types of things we're going to have to look at and make these kind of quick determinations as to what source of funding we're going to use. If at a later date or if there's more time allowed before we have to initiate a response action, maybe we can get in a dialogue with our case officers at the National Pollution Fund Center, kind of work it by them. But in those true emergency situations, you just go with what you do know about the spill. So I guess we have a little time for questions. Have we had any questions come up?
Thanks. We did have one or two questions that did pop in, and one of them actually came early on, and they just wanted to know if synthetic oil that's now being used in automobiles be classified as an oil under these rules.
And yes, it would. The synthetic motor oils are considered to be oils. Some of the silicone fluids, some of the dielectric fluids that the electrical utilities use, those materials we generally do consider oil. And as long as they don't have CERCLA hazardous substances of any great quantity in them, as far as I know, the National Pollution Fund Center has agreed with EPA and allowed funding for the cleanup of those spills.
Okay. Again, just a reminder for those of you who are still on the line, you can submit your questions and comments by using that Q&A window in the lower right corner. I'm going to wait just a moment longer to see if we have any other comments or questions that come in. And let's see if it looks like we might have one more. I think someone's trying to type something up, but they haven't quite submitted it just yet. So if you want to continue on with the presentation, we did have one participant who submitted a comment regarding a URL. It looks like there was a URL that wasn't working, so I'm going to go ahead and try to fix that URL. But we looks like we got another comment coming in, but I don't think they're going to quite get it typed up just yet. So perhaps are there any other, let me give them one more second, any thoughts or any things you guys want to share or want to discuss back and forth? While we're waiting, they got it in here. We do have a participant who finished their question, and they asked, if we have a fish oil response that impacts wildlife and we, the state, incur cost to respond to this, can we submit a claim to the OLTF for cost recovery if properly documented?
Yeah, you know, fish oil is considered an oil by EPA and by the fund center, so we can access the fund. You know, especially for the states, I know in New York and New Jersey, in within Region 2, those two states do not recognize biological oils under their state programs. So what they would do is automatically just refer it to the federal government, either the Coast Guard or EPA, because they know it's not within their authorities to go ahead, their state authorities, to go ahead and address that type of thing. As far as claims go, you know, for states, what the fund center will more than likely look for is that the state's actions were consistent with the NCP, and they would look for EPA's input as to whether or not the state's actions were consistent. And that basically means that we talk to each other, that, you know, the state made EPA or the Coast Guard aware of the spill, and that the response was coordinated between the states and the federal government in responding to the fish oil or the vegetable oil spill.
This is Greg. I think expanding on that, at least in the Northwest states, they prefer to do that kind of work, but under a PRFA, where they know that there is not that question about whether their efforts are consistent with the NCP, because if they're implementing implementing work under a pollution removal funding authorization, they in essence are working on the behalf of the OSC.
Okay. Jim,
well,
do you have a comment?
Does that, I'm a little confused here. Does that mean that the states can directly access the fund not at the direction of the OSC, but independent of the OSC, so to speak, but with the expectation that there's been coordination and agreement? Or can they only access it at the direction of an OSC?
This is Greg. There is a mechanism for state direct access to the fund, and that has to be that mechanism has to be established beforehand, and it requires, I think, a letter from the governor. And I don't know if there are any states that have set that up. There are certainly no states in our region that have set that up. They prefer to work under a PRFA. Do you know of any, Doug, that have a state direct access?
No, I don't. And as a matter of fact, I believe the Fund Center is seeking a legislative fix to remove state direct access to the fund because no states have chosen to use it. But you're correct. Most states either go through the pollution removal funding authorizations, which are kind of handed out by the OSCs to the states, or submitting claims to reimburse the state's costs for responding to an oil spill.
So that would essentially be a damage claim then, huh?
Correct. Third-party claim, yep. Damage.
Yeah.
Okay. We have a participant that would like to know, what about oil-based drilling fluids, such as those from an oil platform? Are those covered?
You know, they are. You know, those oil-based drilling fluids are just like oil-based paints. Again, it's such a broad and comprehensive term in the statute and the regulations. Again, you know, it's not just the fact that it's an oil that qualifies it to be removed by the federal government. There is these criteria that we need to meet. Not just is it an oil, but also we'll be getting into, is there an actual or a threatened discharge to a surface water? And so we'll be looking at those factors as well. But the oil-based drilling fluids, if they got into the water, surface water, yes, we would be able to access the fund for them.
Okay. We also have another participant that would like to know, what exactly is, quote, dredged spoil?
Well, if you live along the east or west coast, you're probably pretty familiar with it, but dredging operations occur in many of the estuaries and harbors in the coastal areas, and it's basically channel widening, channel deepening for commercial vessels to be able to get in and out of ports. sometimes, especially like in the New York Harbor area, when they are dredging, removing the dredge spoils from the channels, they will encounter oil. And really what they're just doing is kind of rearranging the sediments. So if a discharge happens there, the OSCs cannot go out and kind of issue penalties and conduct a removal action. Those are generally handled by the Army Corps of Engineers and some other entities. But the dredge spoils are those materials that are removed during those dredging operations, removing sediment from channels.
Okay. Let's go ahead and carry on with the presentation. We are on slide number 66, and we've got approximately 45 minutes left. For those participants who are still asking questions, you can keep submitting them into the queue, and we'll try to address them what we can in the next question and answer break that we take.
All right. This is Doug again, and we're going to move on to the fate and behavior of oil in the environment. So, several physical and chemical properties are useful to OSCs because they not only tell us about the oil itself, but they determine what technologies will work in responding to that oil spill. Now, specific gravity of a substance is the comparison of the density of that material, in this case oil, to that of water. So if you have a specific gravity of less than 1, it's going to float on the water. If the specific gravity is greater than 1, it's going to sink in the water. The majority of oils do float, but we do encounter oils that sink as well, but the majority of them do float. This has great significance to the oil spill cleanup itself. So in general, specific gravity of a spilled oil will increase over time as the volatiles evaporate and the material tends to become more dense. Now, surface tension is the force of attraction between the surface molecules of a liquid. So the surface tension together with viscosity affect the rate of spread over the water or over the ground. The lower the surface tension, the greater its potential for spreading. Low surface tension characteristics. Low surface tensions are characteristic of low specific gravity oils. So as temperatures increase, the surface tension decreases, and the rate of spread increases. Viscosity of an oil is a measure of the oil's resistance to shear. Viscosity is more commonly known as resistance to flow. High viscosity implies a high resistance to flow, while low viscosity indicates a low resistance to flow. Viscosity changes with temperature, and decreasing temperature increases viscosity. Viscosity is determined by the amount of the light ends in the oil. Viscosity affects oil spill cleanups because it influences the spreading rate of the slick, the stickiness of the oil, the penetration of the oil into soil or the adjoining shoreline or beaches, as well as the ability of response equipment to pump the oil or to remove or remove the oil from the water. Now, bear with me for 1 minute here. Just want to say, let's just back up 1 minute. So if we have, let me just give you an example. If we have an oil which has a low surface tension, a low specific gravity, and a low viscosity, what kind of implications would it have during an oil spill? Well, the spill will spread rapidly. spread of the slick will increase with increasing temperature. It's going to be the possible flash or fire hazard. And the evaporation of the light ends is going to occur, so that's going to mean that there'll be the evaporation of the more toxic fractions of the oil. So personal protective equipment is going to be needed by the cleanup crew. Now, the recovery rate of the cleanup is probably going to be pretty low because of all that evaporation going on. And because of the evaporation and the light ends coming off, there's likely that citizens and elected officials are going to be complaining about the oil spill. Now let's move on to pour point. Pour point is the temperature at which the oil becomes plastic or semi-solid and will not flow. It overrides the effects of viscosity and surface tension. Lighter oils with low viscosities have lower pour points. And heavy oils may become solid on cold water or may become fluid when sitting in the sun on the shoreline and then start penetrating into the shoreline. A flash point is the temperature at which oil vapors will ignite. It must be known because of, you know, the safety reasons. Lighter, volatile oils, once spilled, will gradually lose their lighter components through evaporation and dispersion. So you got to make sure that you're aware of the fire hazards, and you can't let it disperse into your lungs. You got to wear your personal protective gear. Solubility of an oil is generally very low. It's roughly, for an average oil, about 5 parts per million. Which is about 1 grain of sugar in a cup of water. So it is pretty minor. The thing is, despite the low solubility, it can have important consequences because of the potential toxicity of these hydrocarbons to aquatic organisms. I mean, they're just not used to having this kind of material around in their environment. Now, the physical and biological effects of an oil spill, you know, these are the physical and the chemical properties affect these things. They affect the physical and biological effects of the oil spill, the behavior of the oil slick, the efficiency of the various cleanup methods, and then the physical and chemical properties of the oil largely determine the thickness, the spreading rate of the slick, and the formation of emulsions. The spreading of the slick, you know, has pretty important, you know, it all is based on these physical and chemical properties. And it also dictates the subsequent breakup of this oil slick as it gets exposed to physical factors in the environment. These physical and chemical properties also affect the rate and extent of emulsification, evaporation, and biodegradation. So we're not trying to make you experts, just kind of aware of a lot of the factors that affect oil spill behavior in the environment and how it affects your response options. One thing you're going to be encountering when you respond to oil spills is the API gravity. API is the American Petroleum Institute, and pure water has an arbitrary API gravity of 10. Light crude oils are generally those with an API gravity over 31 or so, and gasoline generally has an API gravity of about 60, so it's pretty high. Those with an API gravity below 22 are generally regarded heavy oils, and there's an inverse relationship between API gravity and density. The higher the density, the lower the API gravity. Now, the oil industry developed API gravity because of the large volumes of crude oil that get moved around in commerce. And it was a lot easier for them to use metric tons instead of barrels or gallons. So that was the primary purpose. The API gravity is used to convert barrels to metric tons by a pretty complex mathematical formula that we're just not going to go into in this course here. But it is a measure of how heavy or light petroleum liquid is compared to water. Now, if you have a high API gravity oil, It's going to have a low viscosity, low adhesion properties. It's going to have a high tendency to create emulsions. And a crude oil with a high API gravity generally has a higher monetary value, has a lot of those light ends. Now, a low API gravity oil has a high specific gravity. So it's going to have a high viscosity, high adhesion properties. It's going to be sticky. It's going to have a low emulsification tendency. And it's going to tend to have a lower monetary value for these low API gravity crude oils. So if you have a high API gravity oil, it's going to be non-viscous, more light ends, evaporate quickly, will water emulsify, readily oxidize, readily photodegrade, have a fairly low molecular weight, weather rapidly, and the microbes are going to love to eat it. If you have a high, if you have a low API gravity oil, it's going to be viscous, more heavy ends, evaporate slowly, have a low water emulsion tendency, slow oxidation, low photodegradation rates, a high molecular weight, it'll weather very slowly, and not many microbes are going to want to eat that glop. Now, just one word about extra heavy or synthetic crude oils. Crude oil with an API gravity less than 10 is referred to as extra heavy oil or bitumen. And bitumen are derived from the oil sands deposits in Alberta, Canada. That generally has an API gravity of somewhere around 8. Sometimes these oil sands are upgraded to a higher API gravity by incorporating other crude oils or other oils to them. And this upgraded oil is known as synthetic crude oil. So I'll give you an example now. If you have a spill of a very high API gravity crude oil, and you have no other information about it other than you know it's being spilled, what kind of implications does that have for a response? Well, it's going to have a high flash or fire hazard. The evaporation of the light ends is going to be occurring. So that's going to mean you're going to need personal protective equipment for your responders. The equipment of the cleanup is going to have to be matched to that very light end oil spill. And the recovery rate is going to be pretty low because of all that evaporation going on. And those light ends are the more toxic fractions of the crude oil. And again, as we said before, your citizens and your elected officials are probably going to be complaining about those odors that they're smelling. So, all right, now we're going to move on to some of the characteristics of oil after a release, pretty much known as the weathering phenomenon. So if you look at this slide, along the bottom axis you'll see is the time. So you got hours, days, weeks, months, years. And then on the left-hand side, you've got the various weathering factors that we're going to be discussing. You know, if you look at this, it just kind of represents that evaporation and spreading are those things that are going to occur at the highest rates in the initial hours of a discharge of oil. Now, you're also going to be getting some of the dispersion and some of the emulsification happening. But those greatest things are evaporation and spreading. You'll also be getting some dissolution, dissolving of the oil, and some oxidation of the oil, but as you can see, these are pretty minor. And as time goes on, you can see how there's a gradual decrease in these. But, you know, dissolution and oxidation, which are occurring at very small rates, they're kind of constant for the first few days or so. You'll also see after a couple of days, sedimentation starts to take effect. And then after several days or a week or so, biodegradation of the oil starts to occur. So this next slide just kind of goes, you know, graphically represents some of the things we'll go and give some brief descriptions about, but, you know, it's got the spreading, the evaporation, oxidation, emulsification, biodegradation, dispersion, sedimentation. So let's look a little more closely at these things. All right, so spreading. So you got oil. In this case, it's coming up from the sea bottom. It's kind of like deepwater horizon. Now it gets to the surface and it starts spreading. Spreading of the oil and weathering the oil depends on the type of oil and also the climatic conditions. Spreading on water is affected by the wind, the water currents, the force of gravity, and the surface tension. And high viscosity of the oil can limit that spreading. Now, evaporation is the loss of certain fractions, typically the lighter fractions, of the oil to the surrounding atmosphere. Evaporation is influenced by the type of oil, the air and the water temperatures, the turbulence of the water, the wind conditions, and the spreading rate of the slick, the oil itself. Over time, there is less evaporation and the creation of more oil residue. This oil residue has a higher viscosity and a higher specific gravity than the original oil. So the oil itself is changing over time from what was originally discharged. Now, dispersion is basically just the mixing of the oil with the water. Now, what we don't normally go into is that there can be natural dispersion, which is the mechanical mixing of oil and water together, where the oil just kind of gets mixed in with it. What is more commonly discussed during oil spills is the intentional chemical dispersion of oil spills, where if the water column is deep enough and the trustees, the states, the OSC feel that less damage will occur by chemically dispersing the oil into that water column and trying to minimize the amount of oil slick floating on the surface. That is, you know, one of the things, you know, Deepwater Horizon was used, some other spills, especially in the Gulf area, the Gulf of Mexico area, it's used. But keep in mind there is also the natural chemical dispersion that's going to happen out in the environment as well. Now, dissolution is the minor loss of hydrocarbons from dissolution due to the solubility of the oil, and that does tend to be pretty low solubility of most oils. However, if you have a crude oil spill, the sulfur compounds and some of the salts in those crude oils, they do tend to get lost to dissolution. Now, dissolution is a long-term process, as we saw in that first slide, and continues as oxidation and biodegradation produce additional soluble compounds. So again, it's something that's going to be going on for quite a while, but at pretty low rates. Now, oxidation is the chemical combination of the hydrocarbons in the oil with oxygen. Although oxidation is generally a very slow process, it is aided by the oil spreading into a thin film on the water. And oxidation is aided by some of the heavy metals and that you might find in crude oils, and also by the ultraviolet light or photooxidation from sunlight. Some of the sulfur compounds, though, can reduce the rate of oxidation. One of the more important factors in weathering is emulsification. And emulsification is the process by which one liquid is dispersed within another liquid to form small droplets. And we're going to discuss two types of emulsification. And both of these types are formed predominantly by wave action. Now, the first type of emulsification is we're going to discuss is an oil-in-water emulsification. Now, milk is a pretty good example of an oil-in-water emulsification. I'm not talking about homogenized milk that you buy at your grocery store. This is raw milk you would find on a farm. But, you know, you shake it up and it does, the droplets of the milk fat do get dispersed or emulsified within the raw milk itself. So dissolution, oxidation, and biodegradation may be accelerated when you have these oil and water emulsifications. But just as you would experience with raw milk, if you have calm water all of a sudden, the oil tends to recoalesce away from the water, and you get the separate phase of oil and water once again. So the input of energy is very important in maintaining these oil in water emulsifications. Now, one of the more troubling emulsifications is a water in oil emulsification. And now, butter is a good example of a water in oil emulsification. They are extremely stable emulsions, and they may persist for months or years. If you have about 30 to 50% of water in these water-in-oil emulsions, they tend to be free-flowing. But contrary to what you might think, if you get more water, if you get like 50 to 80% water, then you get these creations of these brown, grease-like, what we call chocolate mousse. And the high viscosity and the high specific gravities of these emulsions tend to form these, or high viscosity, high specific gravity oils tend to form these chocolate mousse water and oil emulsifications. Now, further weathering of these chocolate mousses is extremely slow. And the chocolate mousse tends to pick up sand and debris because it's so sticky. And once the evaporation of the water occurs from this mousse, it forms very compact tarry lumps. Now, sedimentation is just the oils may adhere to sediment in the water. And as the addition of the sediment to the mass of oil occurs, it may cause the oil to sink. It may float in the water column. You know, with this addition of sediment to the oil, or it may actually just sink to the very bottom. And biodegradation is the, there's oil-degrading microbes present in just about all aquatic environments to some extent. You know, especially with the spills that have occurred, or in areas where, you know, there's natural weeps or seeps of oil into aquatic environments. These oil-eating microbes are already present. But what's important to us in the oil spill cleanup business is the rate of this biodegradation. And that is dependent upon the temperature, the nutrients that are available, generally nitrogen and phosphorus, and to make sure there's an adequate substrate for these microbes to be able to work and decompose decompose the oil. So that's pretty much it for the weathering process. Again, do we have any questions?
We actually have a quiet group here right now. We do have some outstanding questions from a previous section, so just in the interest of time, I'm going to try to see if I can bring up a question that came up earlier. Bear with me, guys, while I call this one up. We have one participant who's asked a few times if EPA has subrogation rights towards cost recovery in event that insurance has reimbursed a responsible party for an incident.
Probably the best way to answer that is, EPA and our OSCs, we can access the fund to clean up the spill. But when it comes to cost recovery, that is a duty that is taken on by the National Pollution Fund Center. Since they administer and dole out the money for the fund, they also have the responsibility for recovering those costs. So that type of billing and recouping of costs would be left up to the National Pollution Fund Center.
Yeah, this is Jim. I don't know about subrogation specifically, but I will say that in Region 6, that's the Dallas, Texas office of EPA, the National Pollution Fund Center has collected funds from insurance companies for spills. If that's subrogation, so be it. I'm not an attorney.
Okay. Let me see if I've got any other comments. Jim, it looks like that we had a question that came in regarding dispersants, but unfortunately I am unable to pull that up right now on my end. Do you remember the nature of the question that came in on dispersants?
I didn't get to read it quite all, but what I gathered was that the question was, are dispersants used in the inland zone more or more commonly in the ocean environments? And probably I'd let Doug or Greg answer that.
It's pretty rare for chemical dispersants to be used in the inland zone, and the regional response teams that I'm aware of pretty much have either pre-agreements or protocols on how to determine whether dispersants should be used in the coastal zone. And generally that is not in the estuaries, but more in the offshore or, a pretty good distance where there's adequate depth. A rule of thumb is that you want to have, I think it's like 30 feet, 10 meters of water depth in order to disperse the oil chemically and not impact, the biota there. So I don't know, Greg, if you have anything else, sir.
Yeah, I have an example. I have approved use of dispersants once in the inland zone, and it was, pretty small scale, but I'll give you the circumstances because OSCs don't typically approve use of dispersants. It has to go to the RRT, but in a case of an emergency where public life and health is at risk, the OSC can approve use of dispersants, and we did that once where we had gasoline in a storm sewer system right in downtown and LEL concentrations in the storm sewer running under Main Street in Payette, Idaho. We didn't know where the gasoline was coming from. We tried flushing it out with water, and the LEL came back, and I did approve use of dispersant core exit, and this storm sewer system discharged directly into the Payette River. But we felt we had an emergency that we were trying to clean this gasoline out of the storm sewer. And we tried use of dispersant there, and I approved that. So it's one example.
Okay, great. We have one participant that has a question about weathering. They ask, weathering can sometimes be controversial in characterizing product during spill response. What process does EPA use to help ensure transparency?
I'm not sure I understand the question. To be honest, during a spill, we just try to tell the facts as we know it. What can become confusing is sometimes there's a lot that we don't know, and that can sometimes give the appearance that we're not being transparent. But typically, we operate in a unified command, and we share all the facts that we're aware of with the, our response partners, the states, the locals. And it's very important to get the word out to the general public so they're aware of what actions we are taking.
A comment on weathering, Doug. It occurs whether we want it to or not. It's a natural phenomenon. So it does change the character of the product that's spilled in the ways that Doug described through evaporation and emulsification and oxidation and dissolution and so forth. And that's an ongoing process. Much of that weathering occurs in the first few days to first few weeks. And so it is a natural phenomenon, though, and we don't control it. I may have misunderstood the question. Forgive me.
All right. I think that actually may help. We do have another question, though, about evaporation. One of the participants today would like to know if there's anything you can do to reduce the rate of evaporation.
Well, if you have an oil that's going to, with a lot of light ends, it's going to evaporate, there really isn't a lot. You're kind of at the mercy of the temperature and the climate, you know, the weather that's going on with the winds. And so really what you can do is just kind of respond to that. Keep upwind. Just be cognizant of the fact that you have a very volatile oil that's putting up a lot of light ends and awareness. But there's not a lot, you know, if it's in a contained area like a dike around a tank farm, they will try to put foam blankets on it to prevent a fire from occurring. But on open water, that typically is not an option.
Okay. We had a participant that commented a particular type of technology or product that could be used to increase surface tension, which causes the oil to pull into, quote, pancakes, reducing spreading and increasing the ease of collection. Have any of you guys worked with a product like that or have any comments on it?
Well, any of these products first need to be listed on the EPA's product schedule. And these can be dispersants, biological agents, some of these herding or coalescing materials. And so that is the first step and that's done through EPA's headquarters, where they determine whether it meets specific criteria that are listed in the NCP under subpart J. Once they're on that list, they're available for consideration by OSCs for use. We have, you know, discussed the possible use of these materials or some of these materials through our regional response teams. I must say our actual use of these materials has been very minimal because the standard response technologies have been more than adequate or the only viable options available to the OSCs because of the conditions of the actual incident itself.
Okay, great. We've got just under 15 minutes left in the webinar. Why don't we go ahead and carry on with the presentation?
Okay, Jean, thank you. Let me ask you first, is 13 minutes a drop-dead deadline? Do we have the chance to go over 5 minutes or maybe 10 minutes?
We can definitely go over 5 minutes, and as we get to about 3:55 p.m. Eastern, if that's going to happen, we'll just make a decision and we'll let the participants know how much longer we'll be going over.
Okay, because the other option is just to postpone this particular module to tomorrow when we might have more time to recover time that would otherwise be lost. But I'm willing to go either way.
I say go for it now.
Okay. All righty. Factors affecting response and cleanup decisions. This module, I hope, is responsive to any number of questions that have been asked earlier about what are those factors that OSCs and others take into consideration in determining whether or not to respond and or conduct a cleanup. And I've separated these out into both human and environmental or ecological, if you will. From a human perspective, the type of product released, as we just heard, is very important, the type and the amount. Recall that heavy crudes and heavy fuel oils are persistent. They have the potential to travel great distances, whereas if you have refined products such as gasoline and diesel, they may not be as persistent, and they bring about a whole new set of concerns, such as flammability that Greg mentioned and the like. The location of the release can influence the requirement for and the extent of response. For example, I believe Doug at one time mentioned nuisance with respect to odors. This can be very problematic with respect to health concerns and breathing difficulties, and clearly this could have an influence. Cultural artifacts, either through direct contact with oil and or as a result of cleanup operations, could influence it. There may be situations where it's decided not to do anything and just to let things naturally attenuate over time because the resulting damage of cleanup may far exceed any value gained or any cultural or heritage feature that would otherwise be present. The media affected by the release, if you have a discharge, if you will, and in open water or at sea, may be much different than would the media otherwise affected by a shoreline release, and that could influence perceptions of risk. And then, of course, weather. There's seasonal differences with use. Discharge in the winter months may not be as big of a human health issue as would otherwise be the case in during the summer months. Some other ways of looking at this are from the perspective of industry. I've never encountered a situation where industry has not been concerned about restricting access and prolonged closures. They're in business to make a buck, and understandably, they want continuity of their business operations. Management of response operations is another interesting industry concern, particularly when it comes to setting the command structure. Who is in a unified command? What are the different branches, divisions, sections, whatever the case may be? The speed with establishing command, their ones oftentimes are proponents for doing things quickly, whereas the agencies and others may be more interested in a slower paced, more methodical timeline that's arguably more inclusive. What is the decision-making process outside of the command structure? Very important. People in unified command are arguably at the tip of the iceberg, and while there's a lot of authority vested in an OSC and others, the bottom line is we have bosses, we work for an agency, and there's widely varying influences that are constantly impacting us. Another concern that they might have, what is the appropriate role of a responsible party in unified command? Should they be in unified command, or should they be at a lesser level? And then within the unified command structure, where should RP representatives be found? Should they be in charge of logistics, or should they be in charge of operations, or should they be deputies or co-chiefs, so to speak? There's also the issue of the allocation and management of resources. The bottom line is they're paying for it, and there's understandably a concern to ensure that only those resources that are needed are brought in and that they're managed in cost-effective and efficient ways. Of course, costs, which I just alluded to, and then the role of federal, state, local, and tribal governments with respect to decision-making. The third bullet item, organizational context and design and learning, refers to those institutional pressures that bear on the RP, which in turn influence the way in which the organization behaves. Those pressures are from governments, regulators, customers, competitors, the community, interest groups, industry groups, and the like. And you should also keep in mind here is that oftentimes, or in some instances as a result of these pressures, there may be a tendency on behalf of industry to react to perceptions and these pressures as opposed to basing decisions on technical realities or just the landscape in general of agency relationships. And then cost, suffice to say that it varies considerably from one incident to the other. Oftentimes, industry has, as we as well, will have a tendency to rely on hindsight as opposed to just dealing with things as they unfold, and that could be an interesting issue to have to manage. Then there's the political with respect to the various agencies. There's both internal and external agency constraints, interests at varying levels, and the like. The legal restraints are those statutory and regulatory frameworks that we work within, as well as other agreements that might be out there, such as memorandum of agreements, memorandums of understanding, Greg mentioned one of these earlier, I believe, when he referred to Section 7 Endangered Species Act consultation. Another one that crops up often is the National Historic Preservation Act, which is delegated down to the state. And so we typically deal with state historic preservation officers, but then there's also tribal as well. Oftentimes, these larger incidents have no regard for those arbitrary geographic boundaries that we impose upon ourselves. And so you will find that the coordination and the interaction of multiple levels of government can be very challenging, and whether they be legal, geographic, or functional. Hopefully they occur within the context of unified command. And it's also important to keep in mind, as was mentioned earlier, is that agencies have responsibilities beyond the immediate scope of the incident that they are responsible for. And that influences not only the way they think, but the way in which they'll oftentimes react. For example, the Forest Service has a NEPA framework, or a National Historic Policy Act approach, which is not necessarily always conducive to an oil spill incident. Public opinion can be extraordinarily influential, both with perceptions of control, the appropriate role of the responsible party, the role of state, local, and tribal governments, and most importantly, how clean is clean, if you will, which is something that we'll discuss tomorrow in greater detail. And then you have non-governmental interest groups, and needless to say, they oftentimes push for aggressive responses on oiled shorelines or in rivers, and in many instances, that's just not possible. On the flip side, these types of groups or volunteers can enjoy meaningful roles in the response, provided that they're assigned duties that are commensurate with their level of training, their capabilities, and the like. And we'll talk a little bit about that tomorrow as well. Another human issue falls within the realm of socioeconomic. Some areas will have high regional, national, or international importance, while others will rank as locally important. And that will oftentimes influence not only how things are done, but when and the like. Seasonal differences will occur in the sensitivity of these resources and what not to have spill. For example, if there is a spill on the Clearwater when you've got T&E, threatened endangered species, moving upstream spawning, the economic impact of that could be profound with respect to guides and lodging and so on and so forth. The aesthetic appeal, Doug mentioned that, and you know, this refers to the aesthetic and recreational sensibility, if you will, of an area that has been impacted. Has it been degraded in ways that are adverse to the community? The media, interesting issues here with respect to social media or social networks and channels such as Facebook and Twitter and how, if you've got different entities not functioning under a JIC or a Joint Information Center, how difficult and challenging it can be to get messages out to the public so that things are in fact transparent and they understand that it's a united front. And the other thing to keep in mind is that communications may not be directly transferable across different mediums. Then primary and secondary impacts. The primary impacts are the loss of wages or taxes are lost or that are otherwise gained from cleanup activities. So even though there's a decline, there might be a temporary bump. There could also be a bump, if you will, in the local procurement of goods and services that are needed in furtherance of your cleanup action. I've only got a few more slides to go.
Okay, I'm going to make a quick announcement. Sorry, we're going to go on another at least 5 minutes. I do apologize, but if everyone can hang on with us for another 5 minutes, we'll try to get through the material and share information on how you can provide feedback, get the recording for tomorrow's seminar, as well as get a training certificate for today's session. Thanks so much. Sorry. Go ahead, Earl.
5 minutes will do it. Now, from an ecological perspective, you'll recall that different types of oils have different characteristics. With respect to the location, there's physical characteristics that are different and unique for each location. It could be prevailing winds, it could be currents, it could be water depth, it could be distance from shoreline. And then with respect to item three, as Greg will go into tomorrow, depending upon the type of product, that will influence your technique that is likely chosen to address this, and as well as the standing water, slow-moving water, and the like. Weather. More ecological considerations to keep in mind is what are the physical properties of the spilled oil? Are we dealing with surface sheens, sludges, emulsions, soluble fractions of oil? And Greg went into how this could affect wildlife, whether it be asphyxiation, photosynthesis, respiration, and the like. And there's also, it may be toxic to other animals with respect to movement up the food chain and the accumulation within those aspects of the oil that are harmful within their well-being. Other things that will influence the response is, what are the type of species of wildlife present? Is it when spawning or rearing activities are occurring? Are the migratory activities are occurring, or is it in the dead of winter when perhaps nothing is? The timing of breeding cycles and seasonal migrations as well. So in summary, suffice to say that OSCs and others, along with the natural resource trustees and the likes, take into consideration many and very different issues. In the broadest sense of the word, they're human, which are political, social, economic, they're industry, they're agency-based, and they're environmental, that goes both to the physical aspects of the environment as well as the biological aspects of the environment. And on that note, Jean, I am through.
Okay, great. Thank you so very much. I think what we're going to do is actually keep a capture of all the questions and comments that came in for today's live broadcast. And we will work to try to take some time tomorrow. If there were some outstanding questions that were burning and you really want to get an answer, you can certainly bring them up again in part two of the training delivery. But I also wanted to remind all of the participants that contact information can be found for all of the instructors on the seminar homepage. I'll point you guys to that in just a moment, but you're certainly welcome to reach out to the presenters as well. If questions or thoughts come up later on about specific sites that you're working at, you can certainly reach out and contact them with any questions that you might have. This also applies to those of you watching the recorded version today. I just wanted to check and see if Earl or Jim or any of the other presenters have any final statements they want to make before I start closing things out and let people know how they can get feedback and training certificates.
Look forward to seeing you guys tomorrow.
Excellent. So I want to thank the 127 people who joined us live today for the broadcast. Remember, this is part one of a two-part series looking at oil spill response as part of the CEC training for OSCs. Part two will kick off tomorrow at the exact same time. There will be a different URL, so if you haven't signed up for part two, please go to the Clouin website and make sure you do sign up. We will post a recorded version of today's session in about an hour or so. So for those of you who weren't able to stay on for the full live delivery, you will be able to replay it later on this evening if you like, so that you can stay on board and follow along with part two tomorrow. For those of you that are specifically interested in receiving training certificates, for this particular class, we are coordinating a training certificate issuance, and so you can reach out to Austin from one of our support groups at Tetra Tech. Her email is shown on slide number 94, and you can work with Austin to get a copy of an actual hard copy training certificate. Before you do that, though, I do want to remind everybody there are a couple of things you may want to do, and that's to download a copy of the slides and submit feedback for today's session. Many training institutions or accrediting bodies won't necessarily automatically accept participation in a webinar, and they need you to verify that you attended the whole session. So for those of you that did join us for the live broadcast today or might be replaying the entire broadcast online, I would encourage you to download a copy of the presentation materials and also submit feedback. If you follow the links that appear to the right-hand side of the page under related URLs, you'll see one that says seminar feedback. You can click on that and actually share your thoughts for today's session. When you fill out that feedback form, it will give you an option to request a confirmation email that you can have sent to you, just to at least verify you submitted feedback after the live delivery. So if you couple all of that together, if anybody has any questions on your participation, you should be able to verify you were there for both the whole duration and you provided feedback after the live delivery. And again, Austin can help you get a physical hard copy training certificate if you require it. And then, again, copies of the slides, you'll find that on the seminar resources and links page. So I want to thank the four instructors who did a fantastic job of presenting on today's session. You guys covered a lot of material, and I think you did a phenomenal job integrating and making this a more interactive session. And again, the presentation archive will be available in approximately 1 hour. So if you were registered for today, you will get an email from me with a link to replay the live broadcast. And then again, we'll do the same thing for tomorrow's session. Okay, I think that's the end of the reminders I have for everyone today. Thank you all so very much, and hopefully we'll all talk to you guys for part two tomorrow at 1 p.m. Eastern. Right, thank you all, and hope you have a great rest of your day. This will be the formal conclusion for today's live broadcast.